The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
And if the hippies and the yippies and the disruptors of the systems will shut up,
demented spiritual experience.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley.
Okay, we had a problem here.
P is equal MC squared.
The message is very simple. Think for yourself and question authority.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Shadows in the Dark, live from Charleston, South Carolina tonight. And I do apologize there for kind of the late start. It looks like we're having either a server issue or something going on, but we got it fixed. We are on now. And, of course, you know, through the last 3 years, we've had our fair share of technical issues. So nothing new to us, but I do want to welcome everybody to the show. And like I said, we are broadcasting live from Charleston, South Carolina tonight. And not only from Charleston, South Carolina, but we are at the historic Charleston Foundation, the building here in in Charleston, South Carolina. And I tell you what, we have, well, of course, now it's getting a little dark outside. We can't see the ocean as well. But for a little bit there, we had a nice ocean view right here at the broadcast table. But we're going to be joined by a few from the, again, the historic Charleston Foundation, and we'll introduce them here in a minute. But I did want to talk to you, or not really talk to you, but tell you a little bit about something we've got going on, some changes that we have finally decided on. And as you know, last show we talked about changing the show name. We felt that we have outgrown Shadows in the Dark, that we have gone way beyond what the show originally started as, and that was a paranormal talk show. We have, you know, we're not ashamed to say that. But we have, you know, again, we've got to where we're talking about so much stuff, you know, interviewing so many different people, bringing so many topics to the show that we felt it just wasn't fitting anymore. And one of the problems was when we go to book a show, we had to explain exactly what the show was about. So at that point, we realized, well, the name did not sum up the show. Well, we did decide on a show name. And we went through a lot of names, many different ones. We had quite a few people working on that. But we finally decided on one that was the simplest, one that was probably going to be the easiest to transition. Now, I'm not real fond of it myself, but, and you'll understand here in just a minute when I tell you what it is. But I'll get over it over time. And that is Jeremiah Greer Live. One of the things I didn't want the show to ever become is some kind of ego trip. And, you know, to me, that name can somewhat say that. But for those who have listened to us for the last 3 years, and those who hopefully will listen to us in the future, they'll quickly realize this is not an ego trip. This show is not about Jeremiah Greer, but it's about life itself and that journey through life. And in my opinion, if you're going to explore life, then you have to look at all aspects of life. And that's where we're going with the show. Essentially, the show will not change. We'll still talk about all the same topics. You're going to see a lot more segments. A couple of them that we are going to introduce is 9 to 5 My Way, which will highlight businesses that are unique, unusual businesses. People who decided to, you know, do their 9 to 5 the way they wanted to. So that's going to be a new segment. We're going to have 10 million ways to yes. And I do want to thank Robert Schneck for that name. I really like the name of that segment. But 10 million ways to yes, we'll look at, human nature and how we respond to certain circumstances and how we can use that understanding of human nature to move forward, to get positive results of what we're trying to do. And some examples would be, let's say a poker player. A poker player has to understand human nature to be a successful poker player. So we may have a professional poker player on the show to talk about, you know, how they identify the tells. How do people respond to different things? What do they look at the poker table? Advertisement. advertisements is a huge thing where understanding human nature is essential. Well, we're going to look at getting advertisers on. So a wide range of people. Now, that's just a couple of the topics that we are, our segments that we are going to start introducing, as well as many others. We're still going to keep the Shadows Throwdown, but we're going to rename it, I don't know, probably just the Throwdown. That's just a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun with that one. Also, the playing of the old-time radio shows, Long John Neville, things like that. Those will still be around. So, but we hope to, you know, again, continue the evolution that the show has seen, especially over the last few months. The 24-hour bash, that'll still continue every year at Ripley's, as long as Ripley's has no problem. And I don't see why they would have a problem with us changing our name. Again, it's essentially still the same show. So, that's what the new name's going to be, Jeremiah Greer Live. Now, we are going to change the URL, and we do apologize because we just changed the URL a month ago. I know we just launched SITDRadio.com, and here we go changing it again. But the good thing is about Jeremiah Greer Live is we don't ever have to change it again. We can do whatever we want to under that name. And it doesn't matter, whereas Shadows in the Dark does hint at the paranormal, the strange, the unusual, and we've gone far beyond that here lately. So I think this name is going to be very fitting and give us, again, the opportunity to just do whatever we want to on the show here. And, we've pretty much done that in the past, and we're going to continue to do that. But enough of that. So you'll see more of that on the website as we, you know, make those changes. You'll see the logo change, all that good stuff. It will be JeremiahGreerLive.com. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a good move. I think it's going to help us to move the show forward and do the things we want to. But I tell you what, we've got a lot about Charleston, South Carolina to talk about tonight. So we're going to take a quick little break. When we come back, we'll introduce our three guests that we have with us tonight. And again, we are live right in Charleston, from the Charleston, the historic Charleston Foundation. So we'll be back in just a moment.
Gullah, the bridge that ties Africa and Europe to America. It is a way of life in the Sea Islands of the Lowcountry of South Carolina and Georgia. It's a blending of West African, European, and Native American cultures that survived the transatlantic slave trade in America. Some 300 years later, it stands as a witness for a great people who survived the horrors of the Middle Passage voyage across the mighty Atlantic and slavery of the African in America. A legacy that perseverance survived and triumphed. It is kept alive through foot stomping, hand clapping, soul stirring plantation melodies, spirituals, vivid storytelling by an elder in the native Gullah tongue, the artistry of a craftsman of sweet grass baskets, quilt making, and let us not forget through the sense of taste, delectable, palate pleasing low country Gullah cuisine. Gumbo, red rice, sweet tater pie, stewed shrimp and grits. And these songs and stories are precious remnants of our ancestors' contributions to the Americas, the world. These spirituals and plantation melodies are sung in the natural style and tongue of the Gullah experience. It is meant to take the listener on a journey back into time. They represent a new birth of songs with techniques and words borrowed from our past. These songs are not rehearsed, but improvised according to the spirit, the feelings of the singer. This is a musical experience for the listener. It is a wonderful blessing for God to have allowed us to be the keepers of the culture. These songs are amazing when you, the listener, allow them to transcend you back into time and to transcend distance to the land of the Gullahs, the beautiful Beaufort Sea Islands of South Carolina.
Well, see, after God heard that the ox was too a valley calling, the animal a two by two, a valley ox, the camel and the kangaroo, a valley calling, the bird got a note from a high chalk, the moon and the star got a note from the sky.
Please, Lord, don't leave me alone.
gotta keep coming from above. But God showed Nora the rainbow sign, saying it wouldn't be water, but find that time, but Lord said, please,
tonight we are broadcasting live from Charleston, South Carolina, right here at the historic Charleston Foundation, and we have three guests with us right here at the foundation. They all are part of it, and I'm going to let them. I'm going to butcher right off the bat. So
everybody does.
All right, so I'll let you say what.
Okay. Fanyo.
Fanyo. Mm-hmm. Fanyo King. We have Brandy
Culp
and Lee
Handle.
And I'm going to get them to shift around just a little bit because we're not picking up as good as we need to. So let's get this mic kind of in the middle of you two. And y'all can share that one. And me and Lee will share this one. And so, Fanyo, we'll start with you, and you can introduce yourself and what you do here with the Historic Foundation.
Okay. I am the manager of volunteer and public relations. So I work in the communications department and just try to let everybody know about all of our great programs and all the wonderful things we do here. And I work very closely with Lee.
So that would make sense. The one with the hardest name to pronounce is the one behind the communications.
Exactly. So, right. Everybody remembers me.
All right, Brandy.
And I'm Brandy Culp, and I'm curator here at Historic Charleston Foundation. So I care for and interpret the art collection at Historic Charleston Foundation. We operate two museum houses, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That'll be neat. Okay. And Leland, everybody let everybody. It's just the warmth in here that's getting to me. But now tell everybody about yourself. And if we'll get you to come up a little bit to the mics.
Sure, Jeremiah. Thank you. I'm Lee Handel, and I'm the Director of Communications and Public Programs here at Historic Charleston Foundation. As such, I work on all of our communications with our various constituencies. And I think perhaps the way people know me most is as the Director of the Festival of Houses and Gardens. That's been an annual program now going into its 64th year.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't take credit for all 64. But the last 13, anyway,
right.
With Fanyo. And the Charleston International Antique Show, which is also held here in Charleston in the spring. And both of those events draw, about 14,000 for the festival and another 3,000 for the antique show. So
we may have to just come back down for that one.
We'd love to have you.
Which antiques is, I love antiques. And, you know, that's something that, you know, if you ride through Charleston, you see a lot of antique shops. Do you tend to see that from your own experiences in older cities? I mean, just seems to be a lot of antiques, kind of a basis. Because like Maggie Valley, Waynesville, where I'm from, we don't have a lot of those.
We do in Charleston, and I bet Brandy can kind of expound on how that culture came to be. Charleston, of course, was first and foremost a seaport throughout its history. And so we receive shipments from all over the world. From China and Europe and the West Indies and everywhere in between. And as such, Charleston was always a very cosmopolitan city.
Mm.
And so we were a blending in many ways of a bunch of different cultures.
Right. Wow. Can you just a little bit more on that? And if I could just keep a little bit up.
Sure, absolutely. I can expand on that. As Lee mentioned, Charleston was rich in material goods. We were, in fact, the wealthiest city in the colony. And as such, as ships were traveling back and forth from Charleston to Asia and Europe and also the coastwise trade here in the Americas, lots of goods were coming and going. And there was a lot of money here, and people were known for having very lavish lifestyles, lavish goods, and it's wonderful to be able to interpret that culture today. And I I believe that the antique shops here are an outgrowth of the love of the arts, but also the rich material that remains in the city.
Mm. And, you know, kind of, you know, on lines of the arts, I mean, you can really see it through the city. I mean, Rainbow Row is just right down the road. And, I mean, it's a beautiful road just to drive down and see. And then some of the architecture on some of the buildings down through this side that we can see out the window are just beautiful. And I'd hate to see what the prices are for some of those, but
many are right about that.
Yeah.
I think our most expensive right now is what, $23 million, y'all?
Oh my goodness!
Is that right?
It's up,
over on LaGree Street.
Now, is it a big house, or is it just because of like location and architecture and the history behind? It
has all of the above,
all the bells and whistles for the perfect historic property.
Mm-hmm. $23 million
and very nicely restored.
I can't even get a $50,000 home, much less $23 million. That's way off. This show better go a long way.
Well, I'll have to note, in talking about antiques, that a lot of folks who, like yourself, enjoy antiques will want to know that in the spring, the city puts on what we call Antiques Week in Charleston, and there are four signature events that make up that week, and they're all fun, and when you're not paying attention, we slip in some education. But they include not only the Charleston International Antique Show that features 32 of the nation's leading dealers in goods from 17th to early 20th century. And you might think that's just furniture, because that's what you think of first, I think, when you hear antiques. But it includes the most interesting things, including estate jewelry, things like couture purses. I love those. We have someone who works in that. Fine art, textiles, fabrics, quilts.
Wow.
What other exciting things, y'all? Majolica.
Ooh, beautiful rugs. Peter Pat.
Great rugs, that's right. Nice. In addition to the Charleston International Antique Show, that week also includes the Festival of Houses and Gardens, where you have a chance to go inside of these private residences. Now, folks like you and Dylan visiting this week, y'all have walked along the streets and enjoyed how beautiful the properties are. But during that month-long festival, it's 30 days where we have the chance to go in and see the interiors and the private gardens of these magnificent private residences.
Wow.
It's a very rare opportunity to look beyond the thresholds and the garden gates. And then the Art and Antiques Forum is another event that goes on that week, and it's a very educational program. Brandy's been one of their featured speakers before for folks who want to learn more about the art and antiques. And then the fourth program in that week is the Charleston Symphony Designer House, which is where some designers will come into a historic property, and each designer takes a room and does beautiful things with it. And so it's just a fabulous week. This year will be March 17 through 20, and we'd love to have folks come and learn more about antiques and decorative arts.
Now, I've noticed, because I have visited Charleston off and on throughout the years. I mean, one, my brother lives down here. And it seems like there's always some kind of festival going on. You know, something to go on. And did you mention one of them was 30 days?
Yes. Fanya and I work every day for 30 days. but we do. Charleston now is a year-round sort of destination, and our season sort of opens in February, I would say. Wouldn't you agree, Fanya?
With the
Southeastern Wildlife Exhibition. And that draws like 50,000 people.
Wow.
It's huge. And then you begin to go into March, and you come up with the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. That's a relatively new program, but very popular. The Cooper River Bridge Run, which I've run in, I'm glad to say. I have conquered the bridge. It hasn't been the last few years, but I've done it. Another humongous event. I think the largest run outside of Atlanta in the southeast. And it, of course, goes over the historic Cooper River Bridge. The new historic Cooper River Bridge. And then, of course, we follow with Antiques Week and Antique Show and Festival. That's all in March and April. And then one of the city's main attractions in May and early June is Spoleto USA, a huge art festival. Mm. I'm sure Brandy can talk some more about that, too, along with our local companion to that, which is the Piccolo Spoleto Festival. It's the festival of two worlds, Spoleto, Italy, and Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I take my vacation. I'm a tourist in my own town. And then after that, we start going into the fall, and we celebrate the most
Mojo Festival, which celebrates our African-American culture and heritage here in the city. Great food, great entertainment, just a real celebration. And then later in the fall, our sort of sister organization in many ways, the Preservation Society of Charleston, sponsors the fall house and garden tours. And so there's always something to do in Charleston.
Yeah, it seems like Charleston seems to like to party a little bit.
and that's historically the case. Remember, it was a port city.
Right,
it is a port
city. Now, kind of a little bit back to the antiques for just a minute. Again, there's a lot of antique shops. Can you tend to find a lot of colonial antiques, things from colonial periods? Because, I mean, for me, I would find that more fascinating, you know, than almost anything because, you know, we're looking at American history, you know, at that point. Can you find a lot of that stuff?
Well, let me back up 1 minute. That's my favorite period as well. it's a very interesting time, and Charleston is very much a colonial city. We talk about walk the wall, the parameters of the wall that existed here in the early 18th century all the way into the late 18th century. And portions of that you can find today, for instance, underneath this building.
I heard about that today. We will get into that later because that was fascinating.
So in terms of the material culture from that period, believe it or not, it's extremely rare. And you'll find very few pieces of colonial silver. And in terms of the antique shops, if you're interested, I know the Silver Vault here in Charleston sometimes has a selection of colonial Charleston-made silver or Southern silver. They specialize in that period. Furniture. You find fewer and fewer pieces of Charleston-made furniture, and you ask why. Well, it's not because it was rare in its own day. We've already talked about the mass quantity of things imported to this city.
Right.
But we had a disproportionate number of craftsmen to overall population during the colonial period. And that's because people here could pay money to sustain these individuals. Time is money, just like it was today, just then as today. So these men were here to make a living, and Charleston was known as a prime spot for cabinet makers, silver makers, upholsterers, individuals dealing in expensive textiles. We think about furniture being expensive, but in that period, textiles were the most expensive things that you would buy. So your window treatments, your bed hangings, the things that you displayed in your best bedchamber, and all of these people were here in the city producing countless numbers of items. And, for instance, we have a noted furniture maker, one of many, one of over 60, and we're talking mid-18th century, so 1750s, 1760s. And Thomas Elf, his account book survives. And in a seven-year period, there are more than 1,500 items in his account book that he produced.
Wow.
Now, believe it or not, that's just 7 years out of a very long career here. But we do not know of a single piece of signed Elf furniture. So we can't say that's Elf or that's Elf. But because the account book survives, he is the most noted, and you go into some historic houses and they'll say, oh, this is Elf, or a collector will say, this is Elf. But there were a great number of men, just like Elf, churning out this furniture with ornate carving. And we call that period perhaps Chippendale or Rococo, and that's where you see those beautiful naturalistic flourishes.
Mm-hmm.
Charleston is looking directly across the Atlantic, so the goods made here in Charleston look very similar to the furnishings and silver that you would find abroad.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes back, so you might want to ask, why? Why is it so rare? What happened to it? Well, there are a lot of things that happened. You have to think about the fact that Charleston endured two military occupations. You had the British, and also during the Civil War. There was a great deal of destruction, rather. Then you have countless natural disasters. But then there's also information coming to light. We're starting to look at that post-Reconstruction period. What happened to material then? We know that there was a great interest in the furniture, in particular the furniture and silver here in Charleston, and we know that a great deal of it did leave the city quietly, and that's why preservation is necessary, and the preservation of not only our built environment in terms of our buildings, but our culture, and culture is represented in those things.
You know, Brandy makes reference to the popularity of Charleston furniture in its day, and there's a historic reference I brought that I think really does help kind of put perspective on where Charleston stood and all of that. And this was from a Frenchman who visited in the 1780s. And his letters back home note, "Charlestown is in the north what Lima is in the south. Both are capitals of the richest provinces of their respective hemispheres. You may therefore conjecture that both cities must exhibit the appearances necessarily resulting from riches. Here the produce of this extensive territory concentrates. The inhabitants are the gayest in America. It is called the center of our beau monde." So kind of a nice little reading. One of the finest houses in America is here, two of them at least, finest houses in America here. This one I'm thinking of on King Street is a private residence. And we have another historic letter of a guest who was visiting that property in 1767. And it's probably one of my favorite quotes that really shows how Charlestonians of the 18th century lived. He notes that at that house he was dining in the grandest hall I ever beheld, azure blue satin curtain windows, rich blue paper with gilt, mashy borders, most elegant pictures, excessive grand and costly looking glasses. At Mr. Bruton's sideboard was a very magnificent plate, a very exquisitely wrought goblet, most excellent workmanship and singularly beautiful. A very fine bird kept playing over the room, under our chairs and the table, picking up crumbs, etc., and perching on the window, sideboard, and chairs. Vastly pretty.
Can I expand on that story?
Please do. Yeah.
That is one of my favorite quotes, and it's one of my favorite stories. The reference is being made to a gentleman named Miles Bruton and his home. And Miles Bruton's grandfather was a silversmith, and his father was a merchant. And Miles Bruton became a merchant, and a very successful one at that, but in the Miles Bruton story, it's not a rare one. It's social mobility. And people don't think of the South or Charleston as a very socially mobile place. But in the 18th century, this is where the young man or the woman would come and try their luck and hope to be successful. It was a place that was ripe for opportunity. It was incredibly diverse. It was extremely tolerant from its inception. Charleston was known for its religious tolerance. And so individuals like Miles Bruton, or, for instance, Pierre Manigo, who was a simple turner and joiner in an area outside of the city known for its Huguenot population, his grandsons were born, they were considered gentry. So it's a very interesting time, and Miles Bruton typifies.
So we just had my brother just showed up. he's going to talk a little bit about the music.
It was a little disconcerting. There was someone on the third floor, and it was on a fire escape.
Yeah. Yeah, and my other son. Look, he came as well. So y'all come on in and have a seat. So this is, for y'all haven't met him yet, this is Shane, my older brother, and my second oldest son, Austin.
Oh,
Charleston name.
One L or two L's?
Austin?
For Austin, uh-huh.
Oh, one L or two L's.
Yeah, in Austin.
Oh, no, it's A-U-S-T-I-N.
Austin.
Okay. You're too grounded in Charleston.
I'm like, what? How do you spell? How do you spell Alston?
Well, y'all thought Alston too,
yeah,
didn't
yeah.
you? Sorry, Alston.
All right. Sorry, you can continue.
No. I was finished. It was a poor ending, but I was finished before we had visitors on the fire escape.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now I got to kind of collect myself back. Now, one of the things, too, that I did want to talk about is where we're at. Because when it came in the building, you even pointed out to me there's two different eras here. And the way you explained how this, and whoever wants to talk about this, how this building is, quite honestly, is really fascinating.
Well, we're so lucky to be here. It's the perfect place for Historic Charleston Foundation because, indeed, part of our foundations is that wall from the original walled city of Charleston. We're the only walled city in British North America. Of course, the French had Quebec and the Spanish had St. Augustine, but we were the only English walled city. And in fact, Charleston was so wealthy and expanding so quickly that we soon outgrew our walls, but they remained, and this building was in fact built on top of Granville Bastion. And if I may digress for just a moment, Granville Bastion actually played a unique role in Charleston's history because Spanish ships were sailing into Charleston Harbor, and they'd heard of our wealth, and we can only surmise that they wanted to grab a little bit of that for themselves.
Now, can you explain what Granville Bastion exactly
is? Because
I have no idea personally.
Okay. I should do that. And it was the most heavily fortified portion of the wall, and a bastion is basically sort of the corner.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know. It's like a point. Like a point. Corner. Okay.
Exactly.
It's a fort.
It's a fort. Let's get down to it. That's right.
It's a fort.
Cannons. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So here come the Spanish into Charleston Harbor, and They see Granville Bastion, they see this fort, turn their little ships around, and sail away. So that was Charleston's brush with the Spanish invasion. So then in 1808, Captain Misroon built the Misroon House here and on the remnants of the bastion. And it was wonderful because there were wharves stretching out into the harbor. If you looked at the waterfront, we're right on Charleston Harbor right here. And at that time, these tremendous wharves stretched out into the harbor. There were hundreds of tall ships filling the harbor. And basically, he could look out on his holdings right out his back window from his office because people, had their office and their houses oftentimes. And the Misroons lived here for many, many years. And then it underwent some changes as Charleston's fortunes rose and fell. And it was the Shamrock Boarding House for a while. There's some interesting graffiti behind some of the doors and windows of people who stayed here at that time. And
we used to say it was one of the finest hotels in Charleston, but after some of our restoration work, we're not quite sure of it.
So, but it's wonderful. One of the lessons of preservation is that you really have to preserve all the layers of history because they are all fascinating and they all tell a story. And so in the 1920s, the Omar Shriners purchased the building, and they wanted to expand it into their headquarters and an entertaining space. They hired two really wonderful preservation architects very early. They probably weren't even called that at the time, but that's what they were, preservation architects, Simmons and Lapham. And they did really extensive research on the area. They're the ones who found the wall, the remnants of the Granville Bastion underneath, and documented it. And they sort of put this U-shaped addition around the building. And they were wonderful stewards for many, many years until about, gosh, what is it now, 15 years ago?
Yeah, 1995, I guess, when it came back on the market.
Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, really important. It's sort of an anchor downtown because it's the last building before High Battery, before the water. And so it was really important that there be a presence here that was going to be a good steward and a good example of preservation. And so Historic Charleston Foundation, through some, you know, very generous donors, et cetera, were able to buy the building, restore it, and the wonderful thing, it's an adaptive reuse, is that we basically preserved the 1808 Misrun house, sort of took it back to its appearance as a house, preserved the wonderful architectural details, and then in the 1920s edition of the Omar Shriners, kind of gave it a really contemporary look. And it's great because when you walk in, you know what's old and you know what's new. Yeah. And what's new is beautiful as well, but it complements what is old. And it shows you how the two can blend together and work together, and they don't have to be at odds. And it's really wonderful marriage of the two.
Yeah, well, when I got here earlier today, I didn't even realize that there was basically a house sitting in the middle of it all.
It's a house in the middle of a building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You couldn't tell. And then, you know, she pointed out that this interior wall is actually the exterior wall of the house. And, you know, I was like, wow.
It's fun. You're in. You're out.
Yeah. It's really kind of neat.
Yeah. 19th century? 20th century? Yeah. With a step. And I know I shared with you, Jeremiah, and I'll have to tell Shane and Austin, that you know if you're in the 19th century building or if you're in the 20th century building, because the Misrun family still survives. Captain Misrun's legacy lives on.
Oh, wow.
They're no longer in shipping. They're in lumber, woodwork. And so when we redid this house, the Misrun family was, of course, very interested in its preservation. And so they worked with us to recreate the beautiful hardwood floors. The four historic rooms from 1808 have wide, unpolished planks that run east and west. Mm. And then when you step out into what had been the piazza, the exteriors, I bet piazza is a new word for you, isn't it?
No, I've heard that.
Okay, good. Because your listeners don't know, it's a Charleston porch.
Right.
You know, we can't have just porches, we have piazzas.
Yeah.
Not an Italian square.
Right, not an Italian square.
Yeah,
but
yes, in Asheville
Charleston
we have
porch.
A porch.
Right. But in closing those in, we did the floorboards narrow, highly polished, and running north and south. And so you always know when you're in the historic building and when you're in the early 20th century building. It's really neat.
Wow.
And can I say really quickly, one of my favorite things that the Misrun family gave is sort of a memento, I guess, is a copy of Captain Misrun's headstone that's here at one of the most historic churchyards in town, St. Michael's Churchyard. And it might seem a little odd, but his love of the sea, of shipping, of his ship was so strong that basically his entire headstone is a carving of his ship. And so they gave a sort of duplicate of that that's here in the house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
If you're visiting St. Michael's, as soon as you go in the Meeting Street gate, take a quick right, and I think it's the fifth headstone down.
Mm-hmm.
It's now on the wall because I think they built over it, didn't they? Bless his heart.
They may have. Things change.
I think maybe he's under the sidewalk or in the street now. But his headstone was moved to the wall of the graveyard. So
great. Looking around graveyards is a major pastime for tourists in Charleston.
Yeah. Well,
and for us as well.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they're fascinating.
We've got great ones. And I know we have worked with an expert in the past who could go through and talk about the art of the graves and how people perceived death throughout the centuries here in Charleston, and the funerary art changed as people's perceptions did. There's an interesting grave in St. Michael's that is like a headboard. Right. Looks like a headboard.
So I've seen one that was a bed frame.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not here, but we had one back up in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. It was a bed frame. It was like, that's just so odd.
It was in period practice.
And we have at the Charleston Museum an example, an extant example of an early 18th century basically headboard, footboard, but it, to play on the idea of rest and rest eternally. And luckily it was made of cypress, so it still exists, but that was an early practice. And then from the wooden headboard and footboard, you go to the slate stone that was imported from Newport and other cities in the Northeast. So we were actually importing stones with that iconography. Mm-hmm.
And then you get the skull and crossbones. That's a little creepy looking.
It's a sign of eternity.
Okay. And then I know in the Circular Congregational Church, particularly that's where Nathaniel Russell's buried. I'm sure Brandy will be talking more about Nathaniel Russell as a leading citizen of early 19th century Charleston. But some of the graves in that church are things like columns that have been broken in two, showing that the life was interrupted, perhaps prematurely, but the life had come to an end. And then you've got the oldest grave in Charleston that is an old brick vault. Do you know how old that is, Fanya?
I don't.
It's the oldest in the city, and I can't remember now what 18th century date it has, but families would be buried together. You would go down to the vault. They still do that out at the plantations at Drayton Hall. In Middleton, you'll see family vaults. But it's another interesting thing.
And, of course, another interesting thing about St. Philip's Churchyard is that John C. Calhoun is actually buried not on the side of the graveyard, on the same side of the street as the church, but on the opposite side of Church Street, because even though John C. Calhoun is probably one of the most famous South Carolinians, he was not born in Charleston, and you can only be buried on the church side if you were born in Charleston. If you're from off, you have to go to the other side of the street.
Else, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
And his body moved numerous times, and it was actually sent down to Charleston on a train, and it's because of this new technology of the casket. It was advertised, and basically it was an airtight casket, not of wood, but of metal.
Hmm.
And it preserved his body, and he was, of course, laid in the Capitol, taken by train, buried here, then, of course, with the Civil War, dug up in this metal casket, thank goodness, moved, kept in a safe place, and then returned.
Bless his heart.
So, may he rest in peace.
Yeah. It sounds like it took him a while to get that, though. Goodness.
Yeah. Fanya mentioned John C. Calhoun is one of the most famous Charlestonians, or South Carolinians. Like I said, not originally from Charleston, though. Ended up in Charleston in the end.
And he would not have liked that, because he was not a fan of this.
No, he wasn't.
Really? He thought that this was a debaucherous place full of evil.
My daddy thought the same thing.
He has the tallest monument in Charleston.
Yeah.
Also, in the middle of Marion Square, John C. Calhoun looks down over the city.
Calhoun Street.
Oh, like that part.
That's pretty much what he did.
But let me tell you about some other incredibly famous people here in Charleston. And we'll move up into the present now. Did you know that Stephen Colbert was from Charleston, born here, 1964. In fact, he lived directly across the street.
Now look at him. Now I'm not a big TV fan. That's
he's on the it's on the Colbert Report.
The Colbert Report, yes. Mm-hmm. I love his show. It is a good show. He's funny. I didn't know he was from Charleston.
Yep, he's a Charleston native, born and bred.
And he's on the he's got his name in the NASA International Space Station.
Oh, that's right.
The treadmill.
Been on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah, the treadmill's called the Colbert.
Colbert, that's great. DuBose Hayward was a writer. He wrote the novel Porgy, which was turned into America's first opera, Porgy and Bess. He worked with George Gershwin there. Gershwin came and stayed out at one of our local beaches, Folly Beach, a great place to go and have fun. And so that was particularly significant as America's opera. This one is neat. Fanyo actually found this interesting piece of research. A gentleman named Samuel Augustus Maverick Fania, do you remember what he did?
Oh, I don't remember exactly what he did, but it is after him that the word Maverick was coined. He was originally from Charleston, but I believe he moved out west and got into politics and a few scrapes. Lee might want to refresh our memory.
According to Fania's notes that she wrote some time ago, he refused to brand his cattle.
Right.
No.
According to the rules. And so he was called a maverick. And so I don't know if some of our local national politicians know where that term came from.
Right.
That's where it came from. America's first architect, Robert Mills, is from Charleston. Graduated from my alma mater.
Yes.
College of Charleston, one of its early graduates. And he here locally designed several important buildings, including First Baptist Church, the fireproof building up on Chalmers Street. And I bet y'all have seen some other things that he's designed nationally. He designed the Washington Monument.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
He also designed Charleston's original sewer system that we still have today. And so a lot of the flooding downtown.
Sounds like it was diverse.
Well, you know, it does flood badly, but it is a really old system.
Right.
So can't really blame it. Will Patton, an actor. Yeah, Will Patton was born here in Charleston. Of course, he was on 24. That's my husband's favorite show. Okay, someone we all know and love, Darius Rucker.
Oh, yeah.
And he's about to come out with a new CD soon called Charleston 1966.
He went country.
And this is country.
Yeah,
this one coming
country.
Out. And Brandy had the opportunity to meet him. He did some shots at the Aiken Rhett House for the CD cover.
Oh, wow.
One of our house museums, and Brandy assisted with that. Francis Salvador. I had not been familiar with Mr. Salvador before, but he was actually the first American Jew to be killed in the American Revolution. And he was also the only Jewish person to serve in a Revolutionary Colonial Congress. So kind of interesting. George Alfred Trenum. You know who he was portrayed as?
No, I
can't. Come on, this is the most basic Charleston question.
Oh, I'm not from Charleston. Ask me about the Biltmore House.
Who's the most famous fictional character from Charleston?
The most famous
in
fictional
film
character?
And
it was
literature.
Frankly, I don't give a damn, my dear, if that's it.
That's right.
No.
Frankly, my dear.
No.
I'm going back to Charleston, where...
Life is civilized.
Yes.
It's all movie, yeah.
Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind. You guys.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, in Charleston we have two terms. One's a ben-yeah, I mean you're born here, and a come-yeah. And I can tell y'all are come-yeahs.
Yes, we are. Very much so.
And then moving up again to more current times, General Westmoreland, who commanded the Vietnamese assault, lived in Charleston. So just some kind of interesting...
Wow.
Factoids.
Sounds like a lot of famous people through here.
Yeah, and I was being good not to overburden you with too much history and give you all the historic people like John C. Calhoun, but of course.
Right.
Signers of
the Declaration
of Independence and the Constitution.
And the Constitution, mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's been a real cornerstone. I mean, Brandy referenced, we were the fifth largest city, I think by the 1790s, correct me if I'm wrong. The fifth largest city in America. Let's see, ahead of us was
and very
New York.
Probably the wealthiest.
Yeah,
city.
Definitely the
we
wealthiest.
We were the wealthiest
yeah.
Until the time of the Revolution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, of course, with Charleston being a seaport, the trade winds would drive, as long as folks traveled under sail, you'd go from Europe through the West Indies, catch the Gulf Stream, and you end up in Charleston's port. Mm-hmm. So we were the westernmost point. Then you go back up to sort of where the North Carolina Outer Banks
right.
are, and then the boat would curve back up to Europe. So we were on that very important path. By the 1820s, the steamship had been introduced, and so now you could go wherever,
wherever you
wanted
to. At
that
point, yeah.
And so by the 1820s, Charleston had begun an economic decline from what it enjoyed in the years after the Revolution. And that's when some of our most beautiful architecture actually was produced. The Nathaniel Russell House is probably...
Well, I think before we get into that,
because I was going to shift that to Brandy.
I want you to, before we take the break, because we've been playing some off of a CD that you gave me to play off of here, and tell us a little bit about it, who we're listening to here and what exactly some... Because we're pretty much... We're not going to have really any music through this show. We'll have our typical little commercials, promos, but I want to play a lot off of this.
Yeah, it's great. I love this.
So tell us a little bit about it.
This is actually a group of recordings from Auntie Pearlie Sue, and she is a member of our local Gullah culture, and I'd love to talk more about it when we come back, but essentially that is the very rich African-American tradition that grew up along the Sea Islands of the Low Country, and they have beautiful voices, wonderful stories, magnificent food ways. It's just a great amalgamation of European, Native American, and African traditions. And she sings some beautiful songs and tells some great stories.
All right.
I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, let's do. We're going to play a few off of this. And let's see. I played the introduction. So let's give them. How about Chicken Dinner Money?
That's a story.
Okay,
it's a good
we'll
story.
Do a story.
Yeah, it's
we'll
a good story.
All right, so we'll do Chicken Dinner Money. And let's give them. Let's play one more. What about No Employment Office? Is that pretty good?
That's a story too. Let's see. The Law Been Good is a good song.
Okay. Well, let's do Chicken Dinner Money and
okay.
The Law Been Good then.
Okay, that sounds
right.
great. I love those.
All right, everybody. We'll be back. Continue talking with.
Fanyo.
Thank you. Brandy and Lee. So back in just a moment.
Now I tell you, ain't nothing like getting money in the church to mess up good religious peoples. That's why me, myself, on Pearlie Sue, anytime I know big meeting time is coming up, I gets to praying for I left from there. Well, that's what I did last Sunday, you see, because a new big meeting time was coming up, and we had to have a discussion on how to spend the $23.49 of the chicken dinner monies. So I prayed to myself. I talked to myself before I left the house. I looked myself dead in the eye. I said, Pearlie Sue, I said, God, look at me when I had to talk to you. I said, Listen, yeah. When you go to that church this morning, now you hold your tongue, you hear what I said? I said, God, look at me when I didn't talk to you. I say to myself, I do the best I can. Well, you know they tell me when you're worried about sitting, you have to pray them on out the way. So as I was going down the road, I felt Satan on my side. I said, get thee behind me, Satan. I forgot I had that split in my dress, so, but that's all right. When I got to the church door, I tell him, sit out, ya. You was not going in this church with me, because this is holy ground. Got in there, and I tell you, old pastor was preaching a mighty powerful sermon. I was saying amen and hallelujah all over the place. Then it was time for big meeting. We're now calling this big meetings to orders. I say, so far, so good. Ain't mess up yet. Well, this is, I got it going right. He got up and he started to sing. You know, them old Baptist preacher like the red back. And he said, listen here, congregation. Me and the Deacon Bowles have decided how to spend the $23.49 of the chicken dinner monies. Well, the hair on the back of my neck got to rising up. So I lean over to sister. And I say, sister, why Red and the Deacon got so much to say about the chicken dinner monies? I said, did he clean any worms off the collard greens for the chicken dinner? She said, I said, I lean back over. I said, sister, did Red pick any fat off the chitlin for the chicken dinner? She said, I said, I said, I just need to ask you one more thing. Did he peel a tater for the tater salad for the chicken dinner? She said, no. I said, then why he got so much to say how to spend the $23.49 of the chicken dinner monies? Well, everybody got to shh at me. So I said, I'll just hold my tongue. Well, I did the only Christian thing. I threw my finger up. Cause that's how we do it. Red was looking all about, but I just had my finger going with every eye in it. Finally, he had to call on me. He said, Aunt Pearlie Sue, does you have any question? I said, Red, What y'all gonna spend the $23.49 of the chicken dinner money's on? He said, Polly Sue, us is gonna brutify the church. I said, you gonna brutify the what? He said, us is gonna brutify the church. Then he did a double dip. Oh, I'm telling you, that was my sign. I said, well, let me throw my finger back up. And he got the duck and the dodge, but that's all right. I say, Reb, how you planning on brutifying the church? Well, he said in that real brazen voice, he said, us is going to build a fence around the graveyard. I said, you going to build a what? He said, a fence. I said, a fence? I said, what is a fence? He said, you know them kid thing? I said, a fence around the graveyard. He said, Polly Sue, does you have objection? I said, who, me, Reb? No, I ain't got objection. I got me too. First of all, them ones dead, they ain't never gonna skip. And Rev, I don't see you or nobody else rushing for get in there. So don't waste my $23.49. Not on no graveyard and no fence. That's all I had to say about that.
Well, the Lord been good, everybody.
The Lord been good,
everybody.
The Lord been good.
Well, He's sure been good to me, church. Well, the Lord been good, everybody.
The Lord been good,
everybody. Preacher, he wrong. He kept a preaching, kept a preaching, till it all got right. You know the Lord been good, everybody. The Lord been good, everybody. The
Lord been good.
Well, he sure been
good to me.
Said, you run to the rocks. You keep a running, keep a running, till the rocks cry out. You know the Lord been good, everybody.
The Lord been good,
everybody.
The Lord been good.
Well, He's sure been
good to me.
Well, the Lord been good, everybody.
Welcome back, everybody. We are broadcasting live from Charleston, South Carolina, right here at the historic... did I have that right that time?
Yes.
See, we were just talking about it. We were just talking about it.
So
the historic Charleston Foundation.
Your head.
So, yes, we are broadcasting live from the historic Charleston Foundation.
Good.
And so now what do you want to get into next? Because y'all were talking about, well, number one, people messing up the name. you know, so, you know, we hadn't talked about that. Or the Gullahs, the Gullah culture. So, I mean, we just played a little bit off that CD, so that might be a little more fitting.
I'll tell you what, we really were remiss in not kind of introducing who we are and what we do and why we do it.
Yeah, we just kind of went into it.
And we just kind of jumped right in. And it's because we're all, I think, so enthusiastic about Charleston's history. But Historic Charleston Foundation is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to preserving Charleston's architecture, history, and culture, and to educating the public about the importance of preservation and that culture, including things like the Gullah culture. And probably one of our most important educational assets is Brandy, because she takes an inanimate object that you or I might look at and go, it's a fork. You know, I've seen a fork before.
Right, yeah.
And can tell you about that object and what it meant in context of its historical setting. And she manages our collections at our two museum houses, the Nathaniel Russell House, circa 1808, and the Governor Aiken Rhett House, circa 1820. And I'd love to have her take an opportunity to talk a little bit about those houses because they are open to the public.
Mm, yeah, so. Please.
Wow, I'm blushing. Thank you so much, Lee. Yes, we preserve Charleston's built and cultural environment here in Historic Charleston Foundation, and we operate two museum houses. The Nathaniel Russell House is earlier. It's an example of a federal-style dwelling built by a man named Nathaniel Russell. And earlier we were talking about how individuals came to Charleston to try their luck. And he was one of the most successful. And he originally lived on East Bay Street. We are located on East Bay, so we could have looked at Russell's first townhouse. And like Mishroon, his home faced the bay. And so he could look and see the ships coming and going. And that was his occupation. He was a merchant. He traded anything and everything, from cheese from Philadelphia to Madeira. And the question, we always get to the question of slavery. Russell, he engaged in the slave trade heavily, but not as heavily as some. And he was a merchant, so he was brokering shipments of all manner of goods, and it's an unfortunate circumstance, and yes, that's how it would have been thought in his time. He was simply moving things from one place to another, and that's how he probably thought about it. Mm. So he wasn't a trader per se, as that individual had a different role in this economic climate. But Russell was simply moving goods from one place to another. And so, yes, he was engaged in the slave trade, and he made a lot of money from his mercantile endeavors. And when he was a man in his 50s, he married Sarah Hopton, and she was in her late 30s. Together, they had two daughters, lived on East Bay until circa 1807, and he had had this property for almost 30 years on Meeting Street, and decided to build this grand, beautiful mansion. Now, at this point in his life, he is almost 70 years old, and he has a considerable amount of money. And he's also very well known and respected in the community. He founded organizations such as the Bible Society. His wife helped found the Benevolent Society. Also, one of the first churches here in the city that allowed African Americans and pregnant women to worship. Hmm. So they were very philanthropic. They used their money to benefit the community, in addition to making their life very comfortable and full of splendor. The Russell House is a representation of that then as it is now. And he spared no expense. The architectural details are absolutely stunning. And even today, as we have scholars visit us and the general public, people just marvel as they look up at the ceiling, for instance, in the withdrawing room. Very ornate. Trompe l'oeil finishes throughout. And trompe l'oeil is basically fool the eye. So you look at a door, and it looks like it's mahogany on the surface, and that's because it's painted to look like mahogany, but underneath it's simply southern pine. Huh. So you have this level of detail, and we do not know what Russell's furniture looked like. We can only speculate that it was of the same style late federal style here in America. And it's today, of course, we do not have Russell's furniture, so we have an excellent exhibition space for our own collection, which ranges from the mid-18th century to early 19th century.
And actually, while we're talking about the collections, Brandy's big project these days, bless her heart, she's sweating for more reasons than it's just hot up here, is putting together a major loan exhibition that will be shown in New York City in January, I think January 20th through 31st, at the Winter Antique Show. And, well, she can tell you more about it than I can, but it's going to feature some of the best, most significant items from a number of organizations, including Historic Charleston Foundation's collections in New York, and it's called An Invitation to Charleston.
Oh, wow.
So we hope everyone who might get a chance to see that show in New York in January will come and visit us later on. So
yeah.
Anything you want to add about that show?
Well, Randy? It's very interesting. Museums often sponsor exhibitions. But this is different. This is a different type of exhibition. We are exhibiting at the Winter Antique Show, and this is the premier antique show in the country. Roughly 75 dealers venture to New York, and it is of such high caliber and quality that museum curators are actually found shopping at the Winter Antique Show.
Wow.
Now, what does that have to do with us?
And their organization's budget.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But of
not
course.
Their own.
Yeah, but of and course.
We are a nonprofit.
That's right. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
And, in fact, some of the dealers there at the Winter Antique Show are also here at our Charleston International Antique mm-hmm. Show. And I know we'll go into that more yeah. detail, but there is crossover. But going back to the actual exhibition component, you have an antique show. What does that have to do with a museum? Well, every year, it is a great honor, the Winter Antique Show Committee chooses a nonprofit organization or museum to host an exhibition. And at the Winter Antique Show, we can expect over 25,000 visitors
wow.
to walk past our pavilion or right. exhibition booth. And we are mounting an exhibition mm-hmm. that will focus on Charleston. Through the eyes of Historic Charleston Foundation. We talked about preservation, and we've talked about collecting as a means of preserving, but Historic Charleston Foundation has contributed so much to the fabric of this city. For instance, the Hayward Washington House is a house museum operated by the Charleston Museum. Well, the funds from one of our first Festival of Houses and Gardens went to pay off the mortgage for that
wow.
house museum.
Yeah, 1948.
Wow.
And Historic Charleston Foundation has also been instrumental in Drayton Hall's history and the history of the exchange. So it's fantastic that this organization gets to represent the city and will be bringing roughly 60 objects of all medium, from fine arts, works on paper, all manner of decorative arts, which means furniture, silver, jewelry. We will be taking those objects from Charleston, displaying them in New York, and we hope it's going to be an exhibition space that mirrors the splendor that you see in the city, and interpreting those objects through, of course, labels, but most people just will breeze right by that. So we are also publishing an exhibition catalog so that you'll be able to take this home, and the exhibition will live in our memory as well as our guest
right.
for longer than that two-week yeah. period. But it's a huge endeavor, but yeah. We are so thrilled, and it's such a great honor.
Mm-hmm. Tell them about your favorite piece, our new piece.
Oh, well, one of my
one
most
of your
favorites.
That's true. Yeah, I better not nail it down.
I said preservation via acquisition. And acquisition is the process of bringing objects into the museum collection. We do that by purchasing, by gift, sometimes loan from other institutions or private collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always just absolutely a thrill when we are offered one of those rare items that we talked about earlier.
Right.
Colonial Charleston furniture is extremely difficult to find, and most of the best of is already located in other museum collections. And we were lucky that the Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts, a sister institution in Winston-Salem, they had an embarrassment of riches. They had three Charleston-made easy chairs. An easy chair is commonly known as perhaps a wing chair, a tall back, upholstered sides. In its own time, it was a chair that was associated with the older, the elderly. It's also associated with napping and resting. If you think about all of the furnishings from that period, not so comfortable, right? You really wouldn't want to take a nap in a side chair,
right.
a Chippendale side chair. So the easy chair was your best bet, other than the bed for comfort. And the chair would oftentimes be placed near a heat source, particularly in the Northeast. So going back to the to MESDA, Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts, they offered us one of their three chairs. And it couldn't have been the worst time in the world. It was that 2009 period. Things were so tough. And it's really a testament to Historic Charleston Foundation that we, in hard times, we step up to the plate and we support our mission and we go out on that limb and say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to bring this chair home. Now, what is that? It's just a chair. Well, it's actually more than just a chair. It's one of only 10 known of this particular form. It's pre-Revolutionary War. And out of those 10, not a single example of this form lived in the city.
Huh.
All had left and gone to major museums.
Right.
Outside of Charleston, outside of the state, in fact. So we were bringing something back to the city and that enabled us to interpret the modes and manners of individuals like Russell, but more importantly, like most families here in Charleston. It's really representative of a form that was common among a certain class of people. I mentioned textiles being expensive. It's a chair that combines the upholsterer's work and the cabinet maker, so it was more expensive than most. Mm-hmm. But we're so happy to be able to support our mission. And we are still fundraising for that chair.
key to note.
I promised the board. They said I've lived up to my promises before, and we'll let you try it out one more time. So
and it was a big try. So.
Yeah, it definitely was. We are still fundraising, but I know that we are gaining support.
And hopefully through the Winter Antique Show Loan Exhibition, we'll be able to sort of introduce more information about how Charlestonians have lived throughout the ages through these collections. Now, the Nathaniel Russell House, as we noted, has been impeccably restored to the period of 1808 to 1820. We actually have another museum house here in Charleston called the Aiken Rhett House, and that's where my passion lies.
Right.
It is such a contrast to the Nathaniel Russell House. The Nathaniel Russell House, through Brandy's work and her predecessor's work, has been restored to the nuns. You really step back into that period of 1808 to 1820. But in contrast, the Aiken Rhett provided an interesting interpretive opportunity because it was owned by the same family for about 150 years, right, Fanya?
Yes.
The Aiken family, their one daughter, Henrietta, married a gentleman named Rhett, and there they raised their five children.
I'm only one short.
When you get close, and you're still young, I have faith.
Oh, yes, I did start early.
but that house, because people didn't move into it, new people, unlike so many other Charleston houses where people move in, they redecorate, they do a restoration or make changes, that family, the Aiken Rhett family, in that house just sort of shut off rooms as time went on.
Right.
And I know, as Brandy knows, as I found out when I was volunteering to help one night, you know, when you and I leave home, you walk out the front door, you put your key in the door, you lock it, you hop in your truck. At the Aiken Rhett House, when it's time to shut that house down, I had, and I'm a feminist, but I had to call for some male assistance because it is seriously shutting down a house. It still has the skeleton keys, and you lock the windows with 2x4s, big 2x4s,
yeah.
And of course the windows are humongous. And it just really shows you the difference of how people lived then, and of course it also, again, tells an important part, I think, of the African-American story, because it took that many people to run that house, and my shutting it down that one night certainly showed me it was not a one-person operation. And the Aiken Rhett, in addition to the main house, has fabulous dependency buildings, a kitchen, a laundry, a stable, and the living quarters that the enslaved African-Americans would have lived in. And they are virtually untouched. The wallpaper on the wall was hung by Harriet Aiken in 1858, and Brandy's been doing some more incredible preservation work, or in this case, preservation through conservation. We've got restoration at the Nathaniel Russell, but conservation at the Aiken Rat, and that's a really different experience. I think you're going to take your family by the houses,
yeah.
I hope, this
yeah,
week.
Yeah, we sure, yeah.
And you'll see the difference. But, Brandy, why don't you tell me about the wallpaper and the fabrics that you've been working to preserve?
I'd love to. The Aiken Rat is an example of preserving layers of time. Lee mentioned that the family lived there for 150 years, and it's virtually a time capsule because you really see that you see traces of wallpaper from that early 1830 period and all the way into the 20th century. We have a major conservation project underway. Again, waiting on funding to push it through. We
see how we work that in again.
Yes, I know. Just go ahead. Just keep dropping as many times as you need to.
We'll give you that address
right.
later.
The Aikens traveled abroad on several occasions, and Aiken was a congressman, and he was a unionist. He was very upset what was happening to our nation, and he did not want to see the union dissolved. And
I bet that shocks you for the South Carolina governor.
Yeah.
Just prior to the American Civil War.
Yes. He was a staunch unionist. And he decided, he knew what was happening after the death of Clay and Daniel Webster and Calhoun. Those are individuals that really kept the union together. After their passing, he understood that the tide was turning and that what he feared would come to pass was coming to pass. And he decided to retire. So in 1858, he took his family abroad. And from England to Western Europe to Italy, France, they did one of the grandest of grand tours, returning to the Carolinas with lots of art, and perhaps some new wallpaper and fabrics to create their curtains and to basically spruce up the place a bit. So we actually have that 1858 wallpaper on the wall. Of course, it's not intact as it was in 1858.
And that's an understatement.
Yeah. I'm sure it's a little grungy looking.
It is greatly altered. And in the second floor parlor, you see the most intact of the schematics, and beautiful panels with flocked wallpaper that was once bright red with gold and silver borders, very complex in the way that it was adhered to the wall. The gold and silver borders were actually mimicking wood, again, going back to that trompe l'oeil and the fool of the eye and used in decorating throughout the 19th century. And today it's mellowed to a crimson. And where you do not see the wallpaper, you still see the outlines. And you were talking earlier about the paranormal. Mm. When we talk about ghosts, the Aiken Rat, that's what we're referring to.
Right.
The traces of the past.
Right.
The outlines from the wallpaper, or where the previous wallpaper actually bled onto the wall. And you can see remnants of the greens and the purple hues. Furniture that once, for instance, the corona. A corona is the piece of furniture that's adhered to the ceiling, and you would have these lavish drapes that would hang from this piece of furniture and had a very functional use, mosquito nets, in addition to being very showy with those textiles. And you see the evidence of the corona on the ceiling in the bedroom. So we have these traces of the past of the Aiken Rat that you cannot see at another house museum in the nation.
Yeah.
And then Lee mentioned the dependencies and the slave quarters. And there in the slave quarters, you can see the same traces of the past. We think about whitewashed walls, but when Aiken was decorating the house in the 1830s, and then when he updated it in the 1850s, He's also adding decorative finishes to the living quarters for the enslaved African Americans. And that's a history that we need to explore, and we're currently researching. But we know that there are many faux finishes, and there was a lot of color.
Another giving opportunity for those who would like to support that research into African-American history.
Well, on that note, give your website.
Oh,
you guys
Thank
have
you.
A website, so let everybody know what that is, and I'll put it in the chat room.
And it's a very easy to remember. It's simply historiccharleston.org. So simple enough. And actually, from these various pieces, many of them that Brandy's been talking about, comes another component of our preservation mission, and that is to take some of these historic forms, furniture forms or fabric forms or jewelry, whatever, and we will then license them. We have a licensed products committee. We license them to major manufacturers. Baker Furniture is our furniture partner. G2 works with us on jewelry. Matahedda works on us with China. I think when I read that quote a while ago about with the bird in the dining room, and they talked about the handsome set of plate, that set of plate has, you know, been here in Charleston for a long time. We've got two licensed products, Blue Canton and Sacred Bird and Butterfly. And if you're interested in bringing some of these historic icons into your own home, you can actually find them on that website, many of them. In addition to what's probably the largest collection of books on Charleston history, architecture, gardens, all kind of things. And Fanya has just been working on releasing some information about Philip Simmons, and she can give you a good story on who Philip Simmons is.
Well, before we get into Philip Simmons, there was one more thing about the Aiken Reds that you had mentioned to me earlier today. And I thought also that when you mentioned, and you brought up a point about it, and that was the Swamp Thing.
Oh, gosh. Okay, now Brandy's going to pass out.
but, you know, and on that, because you know, you were talking about how, you know, part of the movie was filmed in that, and I thought it was interesting how you put it was, you know, you had this, you know, Dewey redo, and I'll let you explain what you were talking about and anybody else who wants to.
Well, it's interesting both in the Aiken Red and here at the Mistroon House. You know, another thing we talked about, Jeremiah, is how I have such a firm belief that history is not just about the ancient past. It's about what's happening today, and it's preservation is about the future more than anything, I believe. And in terms of the Aiken Red House, back in the, the victim number one actually was a classmate of mine at the College of Charleston, Nan Brown. She was the medical associate who was the first one killed by Swamp Thing. But when they used the house, it wasn't owned by us. I'll say it was owned by someone else. They went in and painted the walls a very interesting blue. I guess for the cameras
more
or whatever.
Like a gray.
Gray, blue.
Dull gray.
Yeah, somewhere mud mixed in. And, of course, now that I hate to say this because it dates me. Forget I said the part about my classmate being in it. But that paint's been up there now for, help me with the math, 20, 30 years. 30 years, 1980 to 2010.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I went to school as a child prodigy, but that Swamp Thing blue has now become sort of an important part of its history in that at that time the unfortunate circumstance of the way the movie producers painted those two rooms, actually new regulations were passed in the film industry on how to work better and more sensitively with historic properties.
Right.
And so, in fact, the unfortunate experience of the Aiken Red led to very much improved preservation regulations in the film industry. Fanya had talked about the Mason, not Mason, Shriners, who lived, who partied here, I should say, not lived here, partied here at the Mistroon House when it was their temple, headquarters, what have you. And in the 1920s, they put in that beautiful second floor parlor that is the finest room in the house with a beautiful mantelpiece, they put Omar Shrine right in the middle of that mantel, just nailed him right in there. They did the same in what had been the Miss Room's bedroom, stuck him right in the mantel. So the question becomes, Do you rip that off? Do you take the paint off of Aiken Rat? Brandy probably would, I bet.
No, we do have a plan for that.
You do? Okay,
and
good.
I'd love to, you keep going, but I'd love to share that.
Keep what you were going to, because I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I would have forgot.
I want to know the plan, too, because I kind of like Swamp Thing, actually. I think I'm the only one at the foundation that isn't ashamed to talk about it, but it was a great movie. And it's interesting now, because to go back and look at it, I watch it every now and then. I guess I have a cult underside. But in watching it, the house photographs so beautifully. And I had mentioned to you earlier, Jeremiah, when people go through the Aiken Rat, I mean, I always go through it just, you know, lit up like a candle, because I love the property. And if you have to look at it through your mind's eye. If you look at it just with, you know, your eyeballs, you're going to miss a lot of the beauty. I know one of the chairs in among our licensed products is an Aiken chair, and it actually is a very simple form chair, and it comes from the warming kitchen, which is downstairs of the main house, where you bring food from the kitchen to keep it warm before you served it, right outside the back staircase that the slaves would have used for access. And we call it the tulip chair. It's a beautiful, simple chair that was in the slaves area workspace of the house, and now is a beautiful chair that, again, you can purchase. I can't remember who produces it. Do you remember, Fanya? I can't either. It's not Baker, I don't think. But it's a fabulous chair. So you can get everything from that type of chair up to something, you know, more stylish. But again, important part of African American history. So much of that history was not written down. It's an oral tradition, and so any documentation that we can find is very important in helping us to learn more about that story and to get that story out there as well.
All right.
So.
Okay, I'm ready. Another important part of African American history in Charleston was really a legend named Philip Simmons. He died at, gosh, I guess he was about 100.
Yeah, he was real close to
100. Yes, and he came to Charleston from one of the islands in the early, actually Daniel Island, in the early 1900s, and he was sent to Charleston all by himself when he was 8 years old on a boat, and his mother basically just told him to, you know, listen to what his elders told him and to be a good boy and set him on his way. And he came to Charleston, and he looked around in all the shops on the street and became utterly fascinated by the blacksmith shop at an early age. And he kept bothering that blacksmith and bothering him. And finally, by the time he was 13, he became an apprentice. And in that day, it's hard to imagine because he had such a long life. Basically, the blacksmith was still making horseshoes. Because, you know, there were still horses and carts around Charleston. Not a whole lot of automobiles at that time. And so he became a blacksmith, and he turned that into an art form. I mean, you know, horses passed, and what's the blacksmith to do then? Well, he started making these beautiful wrought iron gates and balconies, and in fact, his first commission was a very well-known store that's been on King Street forever called Berlin's, and he made a gate for Berlin's in, I believe it was the 1940s, and since that time, he made hundreds of gates which incorporate these wonderful symbols like an egret, and the heart gate is the one that inspires the new jewelry collection, which is in his memory. And it's basic. It funds both Historic Charleston Foundation and the Philip Simmons Foundation, which is turning his small little home with his blacksmith shop in the back up the peninsula in Charleston. They want to turn that into a museum. And it's a beautiful collection, but he has work at the Smithsonian. He was honored by, oh gosh, was it I can't remember which president it was, but he basically received the highest honor for an artist in the nation. And his work at the South Carolina Museum. You can see, if you come to Charleston, look at the gate in front of the visitor center, because that's one of his, and go to his commemorative garden behind St. John's Episcopal Church in Ansonboro. That was his church, and they are honoring him with a garden behind it. But he really was a legend, and just a great man, so humble and so soft-spoken, and with just such gentleness and wisdom. And
that's great.
Yeah, when he died, what color was the ribbon? I can't remember now, but everyone in Charleston
was green, maybe.
Yeah, I can't remember now, but every one in Charleston who had one of his gates was asked to put a ribbon on it on the day of his funeral, and then they just everybody loved him so much that they just expanded it and said everybody with any sort of wrought iron gate, you know, put put a ribbon on your gate, and so they were all over town. It was so he was very beloved. But you can see a little bit about that collection on our website as well, and you can also check out the Philip Simmons Foundation.
Oh, wow. So there's your Christmas idea for your girlfriends
and
your wives.
It's a heart, yeah. Sir. Perfect for Valentine's Day.
That's right. But it is beautiful jewelry, just like his work was beautiful. And it ties the past with the present, because he apprenticed, of course, with a master blacksmith who had been a slave. And so suddenly history's not so far behind us, is it?
Yeah.
Because Mr. Simmons just passed, what, 2-3 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I know
really?
Goes quickly. He's just recently passed. And he would come out. The next thing I'd love for Fania to talk some more about is the Festival of Houses and Gardens. But he would often come out to our Ansonboro tour, our Anson Street tour, and greet the visitors on days when he felt up to it. And he never got tired of welcoming people to Charleston. He really embodied Charleston's reputation for hospitality. And he would greet the guest in his memorial garden and show them his work. And he was always so humble and charming about it. And the Anson Street tour is a great tour, but he really made it extra special with his presence. But spring's big. Fania has to organize, get this, 750 volunteers to pull this thing off.
And we appreciate every single one of them.
Yes, we love them.
And we need more.
And we need more. That's right. And actually, we have a couple of folks within our volunteer corps who kind of make it a tradition to come visit Charleston for that month in the spring and work.
We have a wonderful couple, the Knapps, who would come from Washington, and I guess they still do, come from Washington State every year to stay in Charleston and volunteer for the festival. We have a wonderful lady from Michigan who comes every year and stays in Charleston to volunteer for the festival. And then we have wonderful folks from all over Charleston, from Awandaw, which is just past Mount Pleasant, to Kiowa, which is on the other end, and all over town, West Ashley, downtown, just from Somerville. Everywhere, Somerville, North Charleston. So people think of Historic Charleston Foundation as being downtown. In fact, just a little bit more about us as an organization, we have covenants and easements. In other words, we protect properties throughout the Lowcountry. In fact, we have a Frank Lloyd Wright designed plantation that has an easement on it, or is protected, and that's in Yemisee, South Carolina. So Historic Charleston, we love our wonderful historic downtown buildings. We love being downtown, but we love having volunteers from all over the country and from all over the city and this area who are in support of our mission, and also just appreciate the importance of preservation and building the sort of character and tradition of a city. And the other thing about volunteering for the festival is it's just plain fun. You get to see historic houses and buildings, the interiors, the insides of the gardens that you would never get to see. I think Lee mentioned you see so many visitors to town, and they love to, as do we all, peer through the wrought iron gates and just press their noses up to those gates and try to see as far back as you can. Right. And as we said, during the festival, those gates swing open and you get to walk inside those gardens and see beyond the gates.
Now, how did you get the owners to kind of warm up to that idea?
Lisa's beg. No, these are also preservationists, the homeowners, and many of them, such an inspiration. In fact, Historic Charleston Foundation gave an award this year at Charter Day to an incredible family who's represented today by a lady named Kathy Forrester, who still lives in this home. But their house has been on tour every year. The festival will be in its 64th year in 2011, and they have put their house on tour every year, except for one, since 1947.
Wow. Yeah.
So really, it is just in support of our mission, in support of the foundation, and realizing, you know, the important work they do. And also, I heard one of the homeowners say this, and I think it's so true for many of them, is that they feel like they're temporary stewards of that property, that house sort of just belongs to history.
Right.
And, you know, they sort of received it and take the best care they can until they pass it on to the next generation. But they're really preserving it for all of us.
Right.
So, you know, that's there couldn't be a more noble reason to open your house. And may I say that it's, you know, a lot of work does go into it. If you're going to have that many people walk through your house, you want it to look,
it's gonna look good.
You know, it's not having your Saturday barbecue. I mean, you really want to make sure that it looks its best.
Right.
And they really do. So, and we invite everyone to come to the festival. It is, it's not just a once-in-a-lifetime experience, because we have people who come back year after year after year, and, you know, come to the festival, do all the tours. Some do the same tour every year.
They do.
I mean, a different street is featured each day. So the houses and gardens would be on that street as well as around that street. So the Church Street Tour, for example, features some of the most historic houses in the city, or some of the oldest houses in the city, I should say. And they're on a little bit of a smaller scale than some later houses because, you know, that's what they were building at the time.
Right.
But their interiors in terms of the carving, the detail, the architectural details are exquisite. And of course, lots of people come to see the homeowners' collections of wonderful decorative objects, and that's there as well. And then Charleston, I think Lee coined this phrase, and I love it. Or actually, you may have borrowed it, which is also a good thing to do when you're in communications.
Yeah.
But that Charleston is a city set in a garden. And
I did steal that.
You did steal it? Okay.
And actually, interestingly enough, I stole it from a 19th century travel brochure.
Well, that shows you how well-preserved Charleston is, that it still holds true.
Well, I never plagiarize anyone living today.
That's right. Yeah, they can't catch you then.
But, you know, Charleston was a travel destination.
I think that's public domain.
Yeah, that's public domain.
Yeah, if it's from there, it's public domain.
But, yeah, we've been a major destination for visitors for 2 centuries.
Yes.
Wow.
And, you know, it is amazing, as Fanya alluded to, is that these homeowners, people assume that perhaps they get a percentage of the proceeds or something like that. They don't get anything at all but a thank you note from me.
No. She writes a really good
thank you note. Yeah,
right.
I do try to write a good thank you note because it is so important, because since 1947, the principal earned income stream for the foundation has been the spring house and garden tours.
Right.
And I think, as Brandy noted, the first year, 1948, the money that was raised through the tours went to pay off the mortgage on the Hayward Washington House, which is a museum property now of the Charleston Museum, and features some fabulous Thomas L. furniture, fabulous furniture all around. But that house would have been at risk of demolition had the mortgage not been paid off. Other times in the past, the money's been raised for different specific things, and of course now it's raised to further our preservation mission and, you know, frankly, keep our doors on and electricity going, although you couldn't tell it from the lack of air conditioning tonight.
It feels good now. It feels better. Like it kicked on or something, because it's a lot cooler.
But the fact that the community turns out 150 property owners are on this tour.
Wow.
And they have no gain. Their only gain is knowing that they have contributed to preserving their community. And Charleston, I think you'll agree, I hope I'm not being vain, is unlike anywhere else in the world. There are a lot of beautiful stories with fabulous historic sites. But Charleston is really like stepping back in time in many ways, street after street, block after block. And that's been made possible through folks who come and visit for Charleston's Spring Festival of Houses and Gardens. And it's phenomenal. Like I said, the 750 volunteers who turn out and give up how much time, Fania?
Oh, well, I mean, it's almost impossible to calculate. I would say thousands of hours because we have a tour every day for a month, for 30
right,
days,
for 30
like you
days.
Said.
I think that's just amazing. I mean, we do a 24-hour broadcast, but now it's like 30 days.
Oh, no. We go for 30
it's
days.
Yeah. Yeah, you got me beat. I don't seem as good now. So.
Well, and we have, I mean, there are volunteers who volunteer for 2 days, and we so appreciate that. People change their schedules. They take off work. I can't say how much I appreciate that. We have others that volunteer practically every day of the festival. And they put so much of their heart and soul into it. I mean, we have had volunteers who, we give you the materials you need in order to volunteer, but there are those who just go that extra mile and kind of study up on their own. If they're going to be stationed in a garden, then they'll, you know, study their garden books and make sure they brush up and all that kind of thing. I mean, I don't want to sound like it's high pressure because it's really a fun thing to do. We just appreciate so much, you know, with what enthusiasm. I mean, they really get us energized and make us enthusiastic and make it fresh every year to see their enthusiasm.
And I can say it's lots of fun. I volunteered with your department for 2 years, and that's one of the most rewarding things to do. And it's so great to learn about the property, learn about the objects, and then share it with all of those people because you get hundreds of people in that door.
And to hear their comments.
Yes, and it's a dialogue that goes back and forth and an interaction that's just so rewarding.
And we have people, thank you, Brandy, and we have people from all over the world who come to the festival. And so if you volunteer or if you're a visitor, you also get to meet people from everywhere. And it's just so, there's such camaraderie and it's so fun. And it's so fun to hear their stories and their take on things and comparing notes. And it's just a great event.
And that's what keeps history alive in Charleston to a great extent. It's, you know, it's we've shared our architectural heritage, our history. Branding, it's our decorative arts, material culture, heritage, and through things like the house museums, the Festival of Houses and Gardens, the antique show, and even through keeping objects alive, say with Philip Simmons and now selling his designs as jewelry. This is what has kept Charleston's history current, if you will.
Yeah.
Otherwise, these would all be forgotten. And so we work hard to ensure that Charleston remains an incredible, I use the term sense of place. So many cities are great, but they're all distinct and unique, and Charleston certainly is, I think, among some of the great cities of the world. And I can say that because I pick on you, Jeremiah, but I'm a Cumia too. I'm not. I think Fania is the only native Charlestonian. Oh, Brandy, you were born here too? Okay.
Oh,
well, then I'm the odd person
out. I guess we split the table pretty well then, actually. Here,
but, I'm a country girl.
Just stay on your side.
That's right. She doesn't mean that.
I'm just kidding.
But yeah, I'm from the from South Carolina, but up close to Myrtle Beach and kind of the rural section, right. I guess would be a kind of
actually,
way to say it.
If I might speak for Charlestonians, we have won the most hospitable city many years in a row. Yeah. Charlestonians are among, I think, the most welcoming people, and we love to see everybody. It's really, it's great to see everyone enjoying the city. I think Charlestonians get a really warm feeling.
Yeah. And how lucky are we to be able to keep that alive?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why we work so cheap.
Now, truth be known, I was actually born in New Jersey.
So
I wasn't even born in the South.
So. That's okay. I don't want you to feel bad because our executive director was born in New Jersey, too.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
So,
but I only lived there
6
months, so I don't think it really counts,
to be honest. I think she was only there for a few months, too.
Yeah, so, and then it was to North Carolina.
But that's great. But So, Liza, we'd love to tell you some more about the Gullah culture in particular.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I think we could probably go ahead and take a break before we really get into anything.
Right.
We'll play a little bit more of that when we come back. And we'll talk about some pirates because
I
love pirates.
I can tell you about pirates.
So we'll talk about some pirates. Also, I have my
can
brother.
Can you do
here.
It in a pirate voice?
Yes.
No.
Do you celebrate National Speak Like a Pirate Day? You ever heard of that?
No, we actually celebrate that here thanks to Catherine Saunders.
Yes.
Who announces
is that not a fun day?
Right.
Yes.
It is a fun day. A little hard to carry out, but it's a fun day.
No, it's so much fun. I worked at a casino, and I worked in IT. And there was 4 guys in our department. That was our IT department. And we're the only ones who celebrated this day. We would even come.
How did that work out for you?
Really good for us. We had fun with it. We would come with eye patches on, little pirate shirts to work. You know, the rest of the casino, there was 1,800 employees that were looking at us like, who are they doing? Because they would have these special days all the time that you could dress a certain way. And, you know, here we all come in with eye patches. What are they doing? It's those SDS guys again. Don't worry about them. So.
It's so funny. The staff that works up here at the Old Exchange where they do interpretation in costume. And they all park down here with the battery. And so we get to see them walking to work. And on any given day, you're driving past, you know, someone in completely colonial garb, you know, shawl and everything, you know, smoking a Marlboro.
I know.
That's funny.
We also have a tour guide. And there have been times that I've been walking home and I pass a man dressed like a pirate with a talking parrot.
A real one.
No, and it's so surreal.
That's what I was going to say. The other day, Jenny, who sits a few desks down from me, said, "What is that noise?" And only in Charleston or only in our building, she finally looked out the window and figured out that it was the pirate, that it was the parrot.
Try walking out your front door.
Pirate's parrot.
The pirate's parrot.
History lives in Charleston.
It sounds like it. We'll take a little break. We'll come. We'll talk pirates. I've got my brother here to talk a little bit about the music of Charleston, because even though he's not from here, he played in Charleston for quite some time. So we'll see how well he knows it. At least the current music. We'll just talk about a little bit of music in general. Anything else? I think we didn't really talk about the when the elevator was put in. Did we ever get to that?
Oh, no, but I'm happy to tell you about it.
Yeah, we'll get into it because I want to hear about it because I thought that was fascinating. So we'll take a break. We'll be back. Again, it is historiccharleston.org, the website, and it's the Historic Charleston Foundation.
Good man.
All right, back in a moment.
Well, now, right after we had a big meeting, my boy, Sonny Boy, not the thief and Sonny Boy. Now, not my husband, Sonny Boy. He had for the other gal. But my boy, Sonny Boy, left from ya, went up to New York, listening to that same Rabin. Rab tell him, boy, going up to New York. Plenty good time for you up there. I said, boy, you better listen to your mammy. You ain't got no business going up to New York and leaving me up with that big yellow gal with them 2 rotten teeth and them 13 snotty nose greedy chillin'. Oh, stay ya. What? He said, no, ma. I was going up north. They tell me better up there. Well, sure enough, it left from ya. Went on up there, following that preacher word. 2 weeks later, he called me on the telephone over to that Mr. Marshall house. I asked him if I said, hello. He said, hello. I said, who this? He said, this be your boy. I said, who is you? He said, Sonny. I said, is you that thief and Sonny? He said, no, ma'am, I the good one. I said, okay, I claim you. What do you want? He said, Mama, I'm up here in New York. I can't find no work for do. What must I do? I said, first of all, you had no business going up there. But hold up. Let me talk to Mr. Mashell. I holler. I said, Mr. Mashell! Mr. Mashell, come here. Come out there and say, well, what you need, Polly Sue? I said, this here, my boy on the phone, yeah. Sonny, not the Tiffin one. They ain't daddy, each other. This one, the mine. This the good Sonny. Yeah, him on the phone. Talk, but he can't find no walk up there in New York. What must I tell that boy? Say, what? What, man? Mr. Mashell say, listen here, you still on the telephone? Mr. Mashell say, you must go to the no employment office. Say, got plenty job there. Yeah, that one. And listen here, put on that brand new suit I buy for you back there in 1949. Yeah, that work. Now listen here, leave your lazy brother Johnny boy. Don't take him with you. Leave him there. Well, now turn, don't listen to your tongue. Cause just like I tell him, for not for left you to start it with, and then the second thing I tell him, for leave that lazy Johnny boy and take him right with him the next morning to the no employment office. It got in there, the man said, next. Well, Johnny boy leapt up first. He ain't wait for my sonny boy to get up. He bust on in the front, going right on in. The man said, would you have a seat? Johnny boy said, thank you, sir. The man said, what kind of skills do you know? How do you have? Tell me what you know. Johnny boy said, I ain't never killed nobody. The man said, no, I asked you. Dad, he said, I want to know what kind of work you know how to do. But Johnny boy said, well, I'm a pilot. The man said, you a pilot? Johnny boy said, oh, yes, I is. The man said, I tell you what, you come back first thing tomorrow morning, we'll have some work for you. Well, Johnny boy, not only is he lazy, too lazy to fight for his own self, but he brazen too. Come out there bragging to my boy, talking about, I got a job. The man tell me for be your first thing tomorrow morning. Say he got plenty of job for pilots. Well, my boy been on there with a smile in his face, cause he said, my lazy brother, Johnny boy can get a job. I know I can get me one. Sure enough, the man said, come on in, have a seat. My boy said, thank you, sir. The man said, what kind of skills you got? My boy said, I ain't never killed nobody. He said, no, son. What kind of work do you know how to do? Well, my boy said, I'm the best woodcutter there ever was. He said, woodcutter, son? He said, we don't have much need for woodcutters up here in New York. My boy said, what you mean? How you heat yourself? How you cook your food if you ain't got no wood stove and thing? Man said, we use electricity up here. My boy said, let what? He said, we use electricity. Well, my boy pick up his hat, he hang his head down low, and bend to walk out the door. But then he turned around and said, sir, I need to ask you one question before I left for Macha. The man said, well, ask me whatever you need to ask me, son. He said, how you hire my lazy brother, Johnny boy, and you won't give a hardworking man like myself a job? Man said, don't you know your brother Johnny boy, that he's a pilot? My boy said, sure, I know he a pilot. I cut the wood, he pilot. Oh, yes, sir. Huh? Bet your boy I'm bring the hip right on back down here to Bruford. Ain't tarry long no more down there in no New York. Yes, sir. Oh, Lordy.
Oh, oh, Lordy, yeah.
Oh,
Well, welcome back, everybody. We are live here in Charleston, South Carolina, and we are at the historic Charleston Foundation with a ocean view. Well, kind of. Again, it is now 11 o'clock, and we can't see out the windows, but trust me, there's an ocean out there. But we are having a lot of fun tonight speaking with Fanyo. So look at there, see?
Yay.
I mean, it took me 2 hours, but I got it.
We did it.
Brandy and Lee, and we are having a good time tonight. And before we went to the break, we mentioned that we were going to talk a little bit, kind of finish this hour off, if we have the time. It's going by very quickly. Mm-hmm. And if we have the time, we'll talk some about the Gullah culture, as well as pirates. And I think we mentioned one more. Oh, yes, the
Mythbusters.
The Mythbusters and the elevator. The elevator. So, well, let's start with the elevator because that won't take as long. That's a little bit of a short one.
That's a short one. Here at the Mystery and House, well, Fanya and I have been here almost 13 years. Mm-hmm. And at that time, while the house was being restored, we all worked up here on the third floor together, like real together, side by side, desk by desk. You'd have to let your partner know if you were fixing to get up so you could back your chair up. But as we were working one day, one of the workers came running upstairs, and I happened to sit right by the front door and said, the supervisor sent me up here, said we hit something. And I was kind of in one of my manic modes, as Brandy noted, during the break. And I was like, I'm sorry, can I help you? You know, you're going to need to find someone to talk to about this. I'm really busy. So thank goodness he went across the room here and spoke with our Associate Director for Preservation, Catherine Saunders, who is an archaeology nut. She's great. And she always keeps like a pair of jeans or shorts in her drawer because sometimes she never knows how her day is going to go. And so she pulled on her old pants and went underneath the building. As Fanya noted, that's where the Granville Bastion is still located, the ruins of that fort. And where they were putting in our elevator shaft here at the Mystery House, they were digging out the bottom part of the shaft where the elevator would sit down at, and they did hit something. And if you could have seen Catherine's face, if you just knew Catherine, she came running back up. She goes, oh, my God, we've hit the wall, 1680. We knew that this area had the wall come through, and we knew the bastion was underneath the building. But in digging out our own elevator shaft, we actually hit it. And so at that point, being the PR person that I am, I stepped in and noted we had two choices. We could either stop work or we could sue ourselves and take ourselves to court. And I recommended we take the easy way out and stop work. And so that is one of the many things at Historic Charleston. You know, just every time we find one answer, it opens another question in history. And you know, we hope one day to do more excavation on that wall. This past year, Catherine and her colleagues from the Charleston Museum and the City of Charleston got together and had the opportunity, the rare opportunity because of some public work stuff that needed to be done, to dig out essentially South Adger's Wharf. And they found another of the Redans, wow, those forts, those kind of triangular forts. And they found, of course, that we knew historically, though we didn't know exactly where, the first city market was there at the end of Elliott Street, and they found the remains of that market, and they found a ton of leather shoes, of all things. Huh. And so, you know, Catherine was hypothesizing that perhaps, you know, there had been a shoe store there or something.
Right.
But they came up with so many artifacts, and it was just so exciting. But it's really exciting to know where we work every day. It's a real motivator.
Yeah.
I know, although your listeners can't see, but you've seen the pictures on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And those are properties that we have been involved with one way or another. Some of them are properties that we've saved, such as Mulberry Plantation, which dates to 1712, 1714, that was going to be turned into a golf community. And we managed to save that property. Another picture that I find particularly poignant is one of the wrecking ball taking down the old Charleston Hotel. Yeah, it's a really dramatic photo. I've used it on a couple publication covers. And it reminds you of what happens if you are not diligent.
Right.
And so, again, just, you know, very motivating reminder of how important the work Historic Charleston Foundation does.
Now, I have to say something about the elevator.
He did take it up.
Yes.
But I warned him.
Well, and it wasn't the fact that it was slow. I can live with that.
But as soon as it opens up, there's an orange emergency flashlight hanging on the rail. Then, you know, that spooks you to start with. Then you go in the elevator and you turn around. Now there's this sign that explains what to do in all these different emergency situations.
That's right.
If the elevator breaks down, the doors don't open. A little scary.
And that
we had training sessions.
Yes.
We've
had staff training. It's very common. And it's because, like I said, we can be tough. We're known as a tough organization, but we, after, you know, looking at our situation, said we will not put in the elevator that we need for the building.
Right.
We're going to put in this, it's not an understatement, say rinky-dink service elevator. And I knew you had a cell phone on you, so I didn't see any point in worrying you. But, yeah, your chances of making it to the third floor, about 50-50. And so we have all the instructions on who to call and how to get out.
The problem was, though, is it was so slow. It takes 15 minutes or so to realize if you have actually stopped or what's going on.
I did warn you about that. I said it's going to take a while.
It was slow. So, you know, I had to send them like, okay, are we stuck? Are we still going?
And the noise. It makes interesting noises, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Well, he thought we must be on the 30th floor instead of the third.
Being in New York.
It was. I mentioned I work at the casino. You know, I worked at the casino, and we had another. It was very slow. And it just had to go two floors, one to two. And it was very slow, but that made that look like a speed elevator.
But the wall is safe.
That's right.
You may not be small price.
You may not be, but what's important is the wall
the
is safe.
The wall is safe.
We have our priorities straight.
I just thought it was the doors open and there's an emergency flashlight. I might be able to carry this stuff
orange.
Upstairs.
We don't want you to miss it.
Yeah. Let's get a little bit into the Golo, because, again, we played some more off of that CD on the break.
I love talking about the Gullah culture. It's something that I've learned a lot more about just this past year. Let's see. I guess the best way to kind of go back and look at Gullah in a historical perspective is that slaves from Africa that came over, that were brought over in the slave ships, they came from several different tribes or areas in Africa, and they spoke different languages. They were different peoples. It wasn't homogenous like we are today. And so they often didn't speak each other's language. They certainly didn't speak English as they came through the Middle Passage voyage. And life on the Sea Island plantations was very
isolated.
Thank you. Yeah, that's it exactly. Very isolated. And so the Gullah people, these enslaved Africans and later enslaved African Americans, cobbled together a language and folkways that really blended European tradition and Native American tradition with, of course, African tradition. And the music and the stories that your listeners have been hearing help share both the language of the Gullah culture, which is so beautiful, I won't try to mangle it, but and it's not just African American either. I remember as a college student here at the College of Charleston, our security guy at the door of our dormitory, who was a Caucasian but was raised locally and on the Sea Islands, and he spoke Gullah and taught me a lot of the words. Like if I was to ask you, you want squeak? What would you say?
I said, what?
What squeak? Let's go eat.
Oh, really?
Squeak.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, and I think on the track you just played before, I done done, the use of the term I've done done is, again, how the language evolved in those isolated areas. It was more than just language. The entire culture included things like foodways. Some of the marvelous foods we associate with the Gullah culture would include red rice, stewed shrimp, sweet potato pie. Lord, there's nothing like sweet potato pie. What else am I missing?
Okra and tomatoes.
Okra and tomatoes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hop and John.
Hop and John.
Which is
that's right.
Cowpea stewed down and then mixed with the rice.
Huh. Yeah, it's wonderful. And also on the tracks that your listeners have heard, I think they've probably learned a little bit about the spirituality of the Gullah culture. And again, it was a mixture of those three cultures, European, African, and local. And so an interesting mix.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong in regards to the gala, because I know we're going to get into, you call it Mythbusters, on what some, yes. what is said on some of the tours. But isn't in some of the houses and the architecture, on like an upper porch, it's painted blue.
Good question.
Right, and that, yeah. does that have to do with the gala culture, having to do with spirits or something along those lines,
it,
right?
It does, and... you know, it's interesting how the myths have changed through the years, but it was common in the Gullah culture to paint the color blue around your windows and doors because that blue was supposed to keep out the haints, the haunts, right. and the plat eyes. And you know what haints, haunts, and plat eyes yes. are? Yes, that's very paranormal.
Yeah.
but we had spoken earlier about our licensed products. We actually have two paint palettes. One's called The Colors of Historic Charleston, and we're, that palette of colors of paint were drawn from the downtown residences, including Russell's Gold, which is in the stair hall at the Russell House, some really fine colors. There's a second palette that's called the Carolina Low Country, and those are colors that have been inspired by the rural areas around Charleston, the sea islands, the beaches, the marshes. I love that palette. And Haint Blue is what it's popularly called, Haint Blue. And people always ask me to, like, give them a PMS color code for any graphic designers in your audience out there. On right. PMS, Pantone, oh, I can't remember what it stands for, but it's a chart of colors.
Right.
And, of course, there is no one Haint Blue because folks used whatever paint they could get their right. their hands on. So it is just a blue. And we have included it in the color palette, but we called it Gullah Blue because we wanted to dispel the myth that there is a Haint Blue.
Right.
Now, my grandmother, who painted her porch ceiling blue, a very light blue, she was, you know, good Methodist, so she wasn't into haints and haunts too much, but, she did note that if you color your porch ceiling blue, that the spiders won't build webs in it because they think it's the sky, and so it keeps bugs down. I don't know how much truth is in that or not.
I don't know. But, Mythbuster over there.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Well, that's right. You just, need to go check
yeah,
the porches
Yeah, go check
now.
Out a few. I don't remember spiders on Grandmama's porch.
Yeah,
piazzas. Come on, we want you to be local now.
That's right. I'm sorry.
Piazza's affected. It's piazza. But, yeah, there are a number of interesting Mythbusters, and... Fanya and I, bless her heart, along with our colleague Catherine Saunders, have spent 2.5 years rewriting the city's tour guide manual, the history of the city. So, and we're not finished yet. It's a big tome. Mm-hmm. But, in there, we've wanted to include a couple of myth busters. And it's one of Fanya's passions. She really hates when these legends are passed down.
Well, I guess some do it to kind of bring an interest or kind of like,
But of course.
But, you know, I guess for you guys, it's all about the truth of the history.
Well,
you know,
and not only that,
what
but
is accurate?
Well, truth
as you
know, is often stranger than fiction.
Right. Well, exactly
dramatic.
What I was going to say.
You know, yeah. for doing this show for 3 years, I can vouch for that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I think the most popular one, folks, when they think of Charleston, if they've been before, always ask the question, why are your houses built sideways?
Mm-hmm.
That's because the narrow end is to the street, where, of course, in suburbia, we have the front of our house is the
right.
long part. And so a lot of the myths have to do with the fact that the windows were taxed or the street frontage was taxed, which isn't the case at all. Charleston was actually one of two designed cities in the colonial days. Philadelphia was the other. And the English philosopher that you might remember from 8th grade civics class or whatever, I have to ask, you know, Austin and Dylan back here, John Locke. Actually designed what we call the grand model of Charleston. And it was a walled city, like St. Augustine and Quebec, and so the lots were very narrow and deep. You would have the main house in the front, of course, with your beautiful ornamental garden where you would entertain and enjoy. And then toward the back area, you would, after the main house ended, you'd have a strip of lawn because fires were so prevalent in Charleston. In fact, if you go to our website, and look for fires. We've got this fabulous GIS maps
right.
that show the fires burning through Charleston from 1740, 1861, 1838. It's a neat map to play with, but see how fire swept through the city. So because of fires, they passed a law that you have to have a strip of green lawn between your main house and your kitchen laundry where you would have your fires. because you could put those out more quickly.
Right.
So in that area of the lot, you would have probably a kitchen garden, an herb garden. That would make sense. And then the back part of your lot, you would probably have your stables. And you might have, of course, certainly horses, but you might have a cow. You might have a goat. You might have a pig. You certainly probably have chickens. And so the lots are very narrow and deep. And so the houses fit sideways. And in addition, just as importantly, as we've noticed today, especially our New Jersey friends, it's hot as heck in Charleston, isn't it? It is one hot city. And so pre-air conditioning, the design of what we call the Charleston single house, that is a central hallway and one room off each side, it was critical if you had to stay in Charleston during the – one thing that's not a myth is an old saying, too. In summer, Charleston is paradise. Excuse me, spring, Charleston is paradise. In summer, it's hell. And in the fall, it's a hospital. because, you know, the heat, the mosquitoes, right, the disease. Yeah. And that's not a myth. That's true. Still true. But you would open your dormers or your cupola at the top of your house, and it would draw the wind, the breeze, such as it was, naturally through your house. Your piazzas, again, very practical. They face south and west. West, they knock down the sun. They help capture the sea breezes. And, again, anything to try to stay cool. On the piazzas, you'd end up sleeping on your piazza because it's too hot to sleep inside. It's too hot to eat inside. It's too hot to live inside. And so you would do a lot of your living on the piazza. And you get interesting furniture like the joggling board that our guests at the Russell House always love. That's another myth. I didn't think about that, but ties right back. The joggling board is a long piece of pine with, what would you call them, runners on each end? Is that a good term?
Runners, rockers.
Rockers. Mm-hmm. And so it jiggles up and down and side to side. Now, the myth, which is a good one, is that it was created so that if you had a maiden aunt that you couldn't quite marry off and needed to work that out, you would set her at one end and her beau at the other end. And just because they bounce, the physics of it, you end up in the middle.
Right.
Of course, on a more realistic note, maybe someone found a good date that way, but actually the joggling board fit perfectly on the long, narrow piazzas. And it was good for rocking babies in the heat to help them sleep. And it also, one time was thought was a myth, but it's not a myth, it helps with arthritis.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So it's a really, it's a Charleston piece of furniture. I'm not sure it's anywhere else, is it, that I know of?
I don't think so. But everyone wants one after they've seen it.
Yeah, go over to the Russell House and joggle. And we do still have a maker in Charleston who produces them in two sizes, the board, which I think is 14 feet, and the bench, which is 8 or 9 feet, I think. But, yeah, so we have our own piece of furniture to fit our own style of houses.
Yeah.
Another myth about taxes, again, is, oh, well, the reason Charleston houses don't have closets is because people were taxed on how many closets they had. And as you'll see at the Aiken Red House, particularly in the slave dependencies, where you have all these pegs on the wall to hang your clothes, Charleston didn't have closets because the clothes hanger wasn't invented until the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century. And without a clothes hanger, a closet becomes a pretty useless area.
Right, yeah.
And when you do have closets, you see them, and you see numerous closets within a Russell House, and that would not have been for clothes. Clothes would have been kept in a clothes press, a double chest, other furniture forms.
Mm-hmm.
But the closets were used for keeping china. Silver usually locked up, so your china, your pewter, and some lesser textiles that you would not have locked. And basically in rooms, and you think of the bedroom, you know, with a closet, well, that would, but no, you were entertaining in your bedroom, and you were actually pulling out your china and your tablecloth.
No, yeah, that's not what you think. I saw your eyes light up on that. What she meant is you would have.
This is a family friendly show.
What she meant is unlike today, where we kind of have our public spaces and our, I guess, dens and great rooms and living rooms that we interpret in suburban life today, is where we entertain. But, for example, at Nathaniel Russell House, you entertain on the second floor primarily. The first floor is so close to street level. You know, Charleston properties generally have zero lot line.
Right.
Nathaniel Russell is an exception. It does have a bit of a front yard. But you would have your dining room and your entertaining spaces
on the second floor, because the first floor, you'd be so close to the noise, the heat, and the horses, and the debris that goes along with all that.
Right, yeah.
So you would dine on the second floor, where you could open your windows, catch a little sea breeze, and be a little bit above the nastiness of the street right outside your window. So that's another popular myth. I think Fanyo's favorite is the ankle myth, so I'll let her share that one.
Yes, the most egregious.
She's really committed to clarifying these misperceptions.
That men walk in a when there's a double staircase outside a house. In other words, the stairs come down on both sides of the door, each side of the door, to the left and to the right. That the house was built that way because men walked up one side and women walked up the other side, so that the men could not catch a glimpse of the woman's ankle.
Oh my goodness.
And the truth is,
that it's all about symmetry. And that, of course, you'd want the house to, you know, the style of the time dictated that things were symmetrical, and it had absolutely nothing to do with the, you know, very alluring ankle.
And then, of course, the pier tables is a myth like unto it, is that, and Grandmama taught me this, so I really hate debunking Grandmama's understanding, is that you'd have a pier table in your hallway, your foyer, I guess, and the mirror is on the bottom of a pier table, and again, it was so you could check to make sure your ankles weren't showing before you left the house. And that's not at all what it was for, Brandy, was it?
No, it was to reflect light. Shiny surfaces were extremely important before we had artificial lighting.
Right.
If you think about natural light, you want to capture it any way you can. So lots of silver, mirrored surfaces, things that reflected the light, such as the faux mirrors, the faux actually window treatments in the Nathaniel Russell house that give this appearance of having windows completely around the room when it's just simply a series of mirrors. So that is the top echelon in trying to capture light.
And that's, again, in bringing history to life, in the Nathaniel Russell, which, again, is a fabulous restoration effort, the colors in there are so bright. If you think historic houses, I should ask the kids this. If you think historic houses, what colors do you think of? Gray and
brown,
light beige, and light green, kind of like in a mental institution or something. Well, if you go in the Nathaniel Russell house, if you're not awake going in, you will be. The colors are so dynamic. And as Brandy's taught us, the colors had to be dynamic because they had to make the most of the light, whether natural or candlelight. And one of the passionate things I feel about the Aiken Rhett house is in the ballroom that Brandy described the wallpaper in, that was a beautiful scarlet and it had gilt and silver. And there are some references to ladies attending balls. Of course, Aiken Rhett house was the center of antebellum Charleston society for many years, and attend balls there, and the ladies are always in soft light because of the gilt and the silver. And so I don't know if it's a myth or not, but I hear no one's ugly at the Aiken Rhett house.
At least not after
dusk. Right, maybe during the day. But, that's really interesting history, because I always thought historic buildings were in boring colors. But they're in vibrant, vibrant colors. The colors at the Nathaniel Russell house really just, not what you think. And so, that, again, how we've tried to capture Charleston's living history through these paint palettes. So if you're interested in painting your house with a historically accurate color, the colors of historic Charleston can recapture those hues. Mm-hmm. The dining room at the Russell House, Verditer Blue is the name, and that was created because, I think, under a bell pull, Brandy, they found a little piece of blue paper. And so that's where that came from. Earlier when we read the historic quote, again, about the bird, running around the dining room, interesting part of preservation is the blue from that room ceiling, I think that had been lost in history until a rat was hanging around the house, and I guess they scooted the rat out, and in going through the rat's nest, the rat had pulled pieces of wallpaper off of that
Wow.
And that was actually a historic rat's nest. That was a period. That was a period rat nest.
It was. So Nola, did you find this paint color? But you also found
we get really excited. Rat nests are perfect places to find fragments of past history, because you have these little varmints going around, and they're picking up bits and pieces, and they're constructing their own home from your home,
and preserving it in the process. Which really gets back, to the heart of our work at Historic Charleston Foundation. And we had talked a little earlier that I'd love to tell your listeners that preservation was a matter of Charlestonians just having great foresight and visionaries and to preserve this fabulous property. But indeed, it's the interesting combination of the fact that Charleston, as we started talking, in the first of the show, was a place of such prominence and wealth. But the other side of that coin is it's also been a place of such horrible tragedies. We mentioned several of the big fires that came through. You've got the American Revolution. Charleston was occupied by the British for 2 years, Vanya, I think. In fact, had their headquarters at the Miles Bruton House where that rat was making its historic nest. And then after the American Revolution, Charleston really blossoms. That's when Nathaniel Russell built his fabulous house in the new federal style of the new country. And today is certainly one of the most important neoclassical houses in America.
It's a National Historic Landmark, and it's well known for its free-flying staircase.
Oh, it's
so
beautiful.
And Russell's gold. You should definitely see it.
So you've got that period of enormous prosperity. We talked about how once the advent of the steamship came along, Charleston began to lose its prominence as a seaport and began an economic decline in the 1820s. Well, you know what came along between the 1820s and 1860? Charleston declined, the rice culture, other places were starting to produce rice. Charleston's system relied completely on slave labor. It just wasn't an industry that could be maintained without slave labor. For one thing, it's interesting that, say, in other parts of the country, California or whatever, well, they weren't in California yet, but in Texas and Louisiana, they were producing rice and beginning to come into the mechanized world. Well, Charleston Pluff Mud, if you've smelled Charleston Pluff Mud since you've been visiting, that kind of really stinky, to most people, stinky, salty smell in the air.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I love it.
I've never heard referred to something. I mean,
yes, it's Pluff Mud. I love it.
Not puff, but pluff.
All true Charlestonians have Pluff Mud in their blood. But you can't put machinery on Pluff Mud because it goes, and, it's gone. So we go up to the years where you got cotton going into the Civil War. Actually, if we're looking out the windows, you can see Fort Sumter from here, where the first shots were fired on April 12th of 1860. And that's, okay, here's
we're
a
coming
word.
Up on
sesquicentennial. I practice that word all day.
Better,
thank you.
You did better with that one than the other one, which I'm not even,
yeah. The sesquicentennial of the Civil War, which will be a commemoration of the event next year. And so, We had the Civil War, which, again, Charleston was occupied by, this time, federal troops, who, again, set up headquarters at the Miles Bruton House. It was a very nice house, rats and all.
And the
Aiken Red House where Beauregard.
The Confederate general, had the Confederate headquarters there for a while because it actually was one of the houses that was outside the range of the bombardment.
From the harbor.
From the harbor. Jefferson Davis visited the Aiken Red House when he was in Charleston.
And all the ladies were beautiful.
Because it was evening.
So you go through the Civil War, and Charleston, again, is just devastated. I can't remember Sherman's quote, William Tecumseh Sherman. But it went along the lines of, if you ever want to see how horrible war is, go and visit Charleston.
He actually did not come to Charleston. Mm-hmm. However, Charleston certainly was devastated.
Right. Well, we always talk about a mythbuster. People have this story about why Sherman didn't burn Charleston, and he had some love here, or he fell in love with the city itself. But the fact of the matter is, Charleston had burned Charleston already.
Right. Charleston was gone practically at that point.
Yeah. It was. We had a tremendous fire.
1861.
In 1861 that wiped out so many of the structures here on this peninsula, so there was no need for Sherman to come through and burn Charleston.
So that's how bad it was. Hmm. And then you've got Reconstruction, and that's a long story, but essentially a point of Reconstruction was to make sure the South, and Charleston in particular, didn't rise again. Because not all of the Charlestonians agreed that the war was over. Right. There were still some holdouts.
And in North Carolina, there's still some who still think it's going on.
Yeah, still here. Some in my family, actually. But sorry, Brandy. You've got Reconstruction, and then you start going into the turn of the century.
Okay, may I use one of the quotations, which many people may have heard, but Charlestonians were too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash.
Yeah,
and that's right. So many of our buildings are simply saved because people were too poor to knock them down and build something new.
Yeah, where Atlanta was, of course, so burned, there was not even walls standing. And so Atlanta is a new city, the new South. In Charleston, it's like our walls stood, but the interiors were burned out. Mm-hmm. And the other major disaster was the earthquake of 1886 on August 31st. I think it's 9:20 p.m. if my memory serves. The largest earthquake ever to strike on the East Coast struck about 10 miles north from here near Middleton Place Plantation. And whatever was left standing in the city after the war pretty much shook down. This building we're in had structural damage to three of its four walls. Wow. It did at that time have a roof, and we then had several major hurricanes come through.
1911
was the big one. Right. And that's the one. We've got pictures of this building, and you'll notice the flooring in this room, of course, is all of the modern 20th century style we talked about earlier, and that's because the roof came off, the third floor came off. You've got three walls structurally damaged from the earthquake, and, you know, what a mess. And Charlestonians did. They ran the earthquake bolts through the house. They were just rods, just metal rods that pulled the walls almost back up into plumb. We know from just doing the shutters on this building, there's not one window in this building that is uniform in size. and that makes it tough. If you notice our shutters tomorrow or sometime while you're visiting, look at it closely and go, that building's kind of off-kilter.
The most interesting thing, actually, if you come on one of our festival tours, take a look at some of the houses. They're literally at the walls are at an angle. I mean, you kind of have to cock your head a little bit for it to look straight.
That's right. You do. You know, everything was handmade, and we've been through so many disasters, and that, you know, we then had briefly had a resurgence with the discovery of phosphate in the Ashley River primarily. That's a thing used in fertilizer. And so it looked like we were going to come back from that. Governor Ben Tillman, who was from the upstate, actually my part of the South Carolina, I'm sorry, I'm Charleston, but Ben was determined that Charleston wasn't going to rise again. The upstate counties of South Carolina have never liked Charleston because they started the war. So,
and also, Tillman instituted prohibition in Charleston and in the state of South Carolina before there was national prohibition, and he did that because of his hatred towards Charleston, and he thought it was a debaucherous place that needed to be put in its place. So you find the speakeasy here before the speakeasy developed in the rest of the nation.
Is that the Blind Tiger?
Yeah.
There's still a pub in town called the Blind Tiger, which the name stems from that era because people would pay money to go in and see a blind tiger, and when they went inside, they would in fact get a pint of beer.
In a private setting, right.
And I don't think there really was a blind tiger, but still remember that today.
Yep. So, the blind tigers. And then we go into the jazz era, the Charleston Renaissance, which if you give us another 3 hours, we'll tell you about.
I can give you 20 minutes.
Well, the Charleston Renaissance saw a resurgence of the arts in Charleston. Mm. God, we didn't even talk about Charles II and his influence on the city.
Or pirates.
Well, I'll wrap it up then on the history. The really quick versions. We had the Renaissance, and then World War I came, and World War II, And the Navy came.
History 101. It's always happening in class, too.
I know, me too.
Yeah. And now it's 2010.
Right.
Yeah,
we
spend 6 months on the Civil War and then like a week
on the rest.
On the rest, yeah. And then Hugo in 1989, which had a huge influence on Charleston, but it's so much.
Yeah.
You got to come back, okay? You got to come back. But I'll tell you a little bit about the pirates because I know you'd ask, and I promised Dylan we'd talk about the pirates. There are probably three pirates of most note here in Charleston. The first one's one that we've all heard, Blackbeard.
Of course.
And he there was a Blackbeard. His name was Edward Teach or Edward Thatch. We've seen it spelled both ways, so no real recommendation on which one's the true one. But he brought four ships and 400 men into Charleston. And one of his most interesting forays, he captured a number of prominent Charlestonians, among them Samuel Ragg and his four-year-old son William, and demanded that Charlestonians send out medicine for his men. He wasn't looking for gold that trip. He was looking for medicine.
Right.
And so the Charlestonians did, and he released the hostages. But it didn't end well because shortly thereafter he was killed up in Virginia.
Right.
But, you know, it shows he had a heart, at least for his crew.
Yeah, he did. You know, he wanted to take care of the people getting the gold for him. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. And then,
it's like health insurance.
Like, that's right. You got to look
that's
after
right,
your men.
Right.
And then 1718 was a big pirate year in Charleston because that year there was another interesting pirate who was put to death that year. His name was Stede Bonnet. He was known as the Gentleman Pirate. He was a wealthy planter's son from Barbados. We don't know exactly what motivated him to become a pirate when he grew up, but, you know, as a man of resources. Stories include, you know, where's the myth? I'm not sure. But stories include that his wife drove him crazy. His father forced him into a loveless marriage, so he became a pirate to get away from his wife. It might be more probable that he was a second son. Barbadians had primogeniture system where the first son inherited everything, and the second and subsequent sons were kind of limited in their options. They could become ministers, lawyers, or... it was a third profession. It wasn't medicine. I can't remember the third profession. Oh, military, of course, military.
Okay.
But other than that, you wouldn't practice a trade because that would reflect badly on the wealth of your family if you had to work. So, you know, unless Stede wanted to go in one of those professions, and if he was a second son, that's another good reason to become a pirate. And then there's a 19th century source that just notes that he was addled in the brain. So among those choices, Stede became a pirate. Now, initially, pirates played an important role in Charleston's economy. The early pirates raided French and Spanish ships, and we thought that was kind of cool.
Right.
Yeah. It's the British Walled City. But then when the French and the Spanish kind of disappeared, the pirates started raiding English ships, and then they were not so cool.
Yeah.
And Stede Bonnet came along at that time, and so he was captured. And bless his heart, when he was brought into Charleston, he was brought before Judge Nicholas Trott. And apparently he pleaded so diligently, and his conduct was so gentlemanly, that many citizens in Charleston kind of forgave him, and that included Colonel Rhett, who had captured him, gone to great trouble to capture him. But Trott would not be stirred. Governor Johnson, in fact, Colonel Rhett actually offered to take Bonnet to England to hear his case again appealed before the king. Pretty nice, you know, for a guy who's just picked you up for piracy. But nothing doing. He was sentenced to death. And so he actually escaped at one point, dressed up in women's clothing, which is tacky for a pirate, and escaped and hung out at Sullivan's Island for a few days. He was eventually recaptured, came back, and he was hanged. And apparently he was so freaked out at his hanging that they really had to kind of help him up into the scaffolding. He couldn't keep his legs under him.
Oh,
and he had a great quote. I want to share, let's see, this quote with you. Yeah, here it is. Bless his heart. Stede Bonnet, terrified of hanging, begged Governor Johnson and Colonel Rhett for pity. He offered to separate, quote, all my limbs from my body, only reserving the use of my tongue to call continually on and pray to the Lord. But unfortunately,
he tried.
He was hanged, bless his heart.
And then the third pirate I was going to mention was named Woolsey, Richard Woolsey.
And I've never heard. Now, the other two I've heard of. Now, Woolsey.
Oh, you hadn't heard Woolsey? Well, Woolsey's claim to fame, like, 1718 was a bad year to be a pirate around Charleston because the government finally decided this is not working for us anymore. you're raiding our own ships, right. And, you know, this has got to come to a stop. So they rounded them up, and with Woolsey, they ended up putting to death 49 pirates that year. And Woolsey's men, after they were hanged, were dumped over the seawall. Now, Charleston's grown physically as a city, and now a lot of what you see is landfill. But at that time, the harbor came just about up to the corner of Meeting and Water Street, which, of course, now is a very nice residential neighborhood. And they were tossed over the seawall so that their bodies would wash back and forth for days in the tide so that people could see, you know, being a pirate is not cool anymore. And so their bodies are undoubtedly somewhere around that intersection under some of the most beautiful homes in Charleston. But those were three that come to mind. So,
And there are female pirates, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know about the female pirates.
Mary Read and Anne Bonny.
So now I've heard of Anne Bonny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they were best friends.
Okay, now I've seen Mary Read's name, but was Anne Bonny, she was a little bit more famous, though, when she didn't marry.
She was a bit more famous.
Because she, if I'm not mistaken, she hung with another famous pirate, male.
Rackman.
Maybe that was
Yeah.
Cool.
And they sailed on his ship, and for a long time, both women undetected because they dressed as men.
Right.
Huh. And I thought I was cool driving a red pickup truck. No, the Charleston women have certainly gone ahead of me. Which actually makes me think if folks might be interested in visiting Charleston when we do the Festival of Houses and Gardens in the spring, we have kind of a side series. Because Fanya and I like to work really hard, along with our colleagues, of course. And every day we have, again, I'm scared to use the word education because I don't want to frighten anybody off, but we have a series of what we call eat and run luncheon lectures and harbor cruises and period musical concerts that are so beautiful in beautiful historic settings. And we cover a range of Charleston topics, including the one that made me think of was, some kind of fascinating women in Charleston's history, but it's a great lecture.
The women of Charleston.
Yeah, of the women who have had such an important impact, particularly in the preservation movement of the 1920s, Susan Pringle Faust, and then when Historic Charleston Foundation was founded in 47, again, Frances Edmonds, who just passed away last month. And so some incredible women. We have topics on the Civil War. We have topics on music. That's really interesting. Our
Charleston cooks.
Charleston
because
cooks.
Our cuisine has become so famous recently.
Yeah, Charleston's become known so much as a food destination.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's owing to the Gullah culture. And so we just have this wide range of really interesting topics. And you eat a sandwich, listen to the speaker right here in this room. So they're small and intimate, so you can interact a lot. I think we only allow 40 people to an event. And so a lot of give and take. And then when you finish your lunch and the presentation, you do a really quick, like 30-minute tour of that topic. For example, if the topic is on antiques, when you finish your meal, you might go to the Russell House and Brandy would give you a behind-the-scenes curatorial tour of maybe some of the pieces at the Russell House that are not yet on display to the public, or talk about some of the silver there. If we have a Civil War topic, the guides might take the group down to White Point Batteries and talk about the cannon and the monuments that are down there and what they all stand for, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a chance to find, and that's how a lot of the stuff I pick up is just coming in and listening to all these different people talk on their little area of expertise, and it's fascinating. So we'd love to. You have an invitation to Charleston. We'd love to have you.
Well, I love Charleston. Like I said, we've been coming down here off and on for a number of years, and now, you know, getting the opportunity, I can't tell you how much I appreciate y'all welcoming the show in to do this and talk about, you know, the history of Charleston, because, you know, even though we do focus a lot on the strange and unusual, we were talking about this earlier, it still comes back to history a lot of times.
You know, when you look into, if you want to talk about, you know, going ghost hunting, mm-hmm. if you're a serious investigator when it comes to paranormal, then you have to understand the history, what happened at that location, what, you know, who were the people that were there, et cetera. And it plays such a vital role in the paranormal. And, you know, a lot of people that aren't really involved in it don't see that.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of paranormal, you know, people interested in paranormal joke around. They say, well, we're really history buffs, because
mm-hmm.
that's what
mm-hmm.
it amounts to, mm-hmm. is trying to understand the history that leads up to this unusual phenomenon.
And I think that's what all goes into creating that sense of place,
mm-hmm.
which for me, I find most passionately expressed at the Aiken Red House. The walls just seem alive to
me.
Yeah,
I can't wait to see that house.
Yeah. I hope you love it. I hope you do. People either get it or they don't. and I just think it's fascinating. And I can picture those folks at the ball.
Right, yeah.
So neat stuff. But we'd love to have you down. So, you know, do visit our website. Look at all the opportunities of we've talked about our two museum houses, Nathaniel Russell and Aiken Rhett. We've talked about our two principal spring earned income programs, the Festival of Houses and Gardens, like I said, going into its 64th incredibly successful
that's
year.
Amazing.
Yep, that's an incredible opportunity. I mean, these folks would let you into their private spaces. And the Charleston International Antique Show. If you want to get a taste before you get here and you're in New York area, go by January 20th and check out the Winter Antique Show with our loan exhibit there. When you get into town, make sure to go by our retail shop at 108 Meeting Street, the Shops of Historic Charleston. If you want to pick up the paint palette and see some historic colors, if you want to pick up one of the China patterns, Blue Canton, Sacred Bird and Butterfly, if you want to look at some of the furniture that Baker makes that have all been based on Charleston pieces, some are exact reproductions and some are adaptations, just a range of products, as well as regular gift items and things. But you can shop. We can do everything. Actually, we can even feed you if you come in the spring because of the eat and run lunches. So we can. I guess we can't put up accommodations for you. You have to find your own hotel. But
I can sleep on the beach.
Okay,
I'm fine with that.
I wouldn't want my boss to know, but the couch in her office is pretty comfortable. And
okay,
if you need
well,
a quick nap,
can
you can
hide.
Sleep in there.
No, I would love to come back sometime, especially during some of the festivals, because. I mean, it just sounds like it would be a really great thing to see.
Yeah.
And please give the website one more time. And of course, they can find all the dates and times for the festivals throughout apparently the entire year.
And the museum houses. Mm-hmm. Our website is historiccharleston.org. The Shops of Historic Charleston is at 108 Meeting Street. The Nathaniel Russell House, 51 Meeting Street. Aiken Red House, 48 Elizabeth Street. Headquarters here, 40 East Bay Street, top of 5 Battery. And what have we left out, ladies?
I think that covers
well, you're still awake, and so I take that as a good sign.
It was great. It was, you know, like I said, there was a lot of interesting stuff talked about. I hope that our listeners, you know, if they've never been to Charleston now, are interested in coming to visit, because, you know, I think it's a beautiful, beautiful city myself. And now,
thank
you know,
you.
Understanding a lot about it, you know, when I go out there tomorrow around the town, you know, I know I'll see it in a different light. And hopefully the two, you know, young kids here behind me will too. I doubt it. But
well, they stayed awake,
they're
too.
Still awake.
Yeah,
they're
still awake.
Still the
awake.
Most impressive part of 3 hours.
That's right.
So, but I really appreciate you three, you know, probably staying up past your bedtimes.
Oh, yeah.
or what.
Oh, yeah.
At least everybody, she's like, no. I really do appreciate, you know, y'all letting us, you know, come here, broadcast from here, talk about Charleston, and staying up with us. It was fantastic.
Oh, it was great to be with you, Jeremiah. You come back anytime you want to, okay?
Well, thank you.
We will set you up.
Thank you so much.
You are more than welcome. I appreciate it. Everybody, visit the website, historiccharleston.org. Check out what all is going on down here. And we are going to get ready to get out of here. And I'm going to play one more track from the CD here. And I tell you what, Lee, what mm-hmm. would be a good one you can fit in the next few minutes here?
Do you want
here?
A song or you want a story?
Either one. You pick one of the best ones that we probably haven't played.
Okay.
And I'll tell you if we played it or not. I only see them by track numbers here. And we'll get that on. And after that, we'll have the Jackal's Head. We'll be on tonight as well.
Oh, number 11, Steal Away to Jesus.
All right, we'll play Still the Way to Jesus, and that's what we're going to leave out with tonight. And I appreciate everybody tuning in. And again, thank you so much to the Historic Charleston Foundation for welcoming us to their building here, their historic location, and you know, giving us a great show tonight. So we will talk to everybody next week, and stay tuned for the Jackal's Head. They are up at midnight. So thank you, everybody. This has been Shadows in the Dark, which will soon be Jeremiah Greer Live. Good night, everybody.
Steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus, steal away, steal away. Stay steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus, steal away, steal away. Stay.